2014. Representative Slocum, we don't yet have a quorum, and so I'm going to ask you to start presenting your bill, and as soon as we get a quorum, we'll move it. But welcome to the committee, Representative Slocum, and testifier, and please go ahead whenever you're ready. Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I would like to move House File 2928.
It's going to the General Register, and we now officially have a quorum. So I would move that House File 2928 be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Slocum.
Thank you. This is a technical bill to criminal vehicular homicide or operation statute. The purpose of this legislation is to separate the criminal vehicular homicide and criminal vehicular operation offenses into two separate statutes. This will enable the judicial branch to transmit necessary information more effectively, efficiently and effectively to the Vehicle Services Division of the Department of Public Safety. Currently, all this information...
Representative Slocum, I'm going to stop you for just a second. Those in the back of the room, you need to take your conversations outside or quiet down. Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Currently, all this information cannot be transmitted electronically, and court staff must manually transmit some of the information to the DVS. Separation of the two offenses will provide more accurate information in public court calendars. Thus, judges, court staff, and the public will not mistake a criminal vehicular operation case for a more serious criminal vehicular homicide case. The DPS was consulted on this legislation. I will now turn over to answer your questions. Chief Judge Peter Cahill of Hennepin County District Court, 4th Judicial District.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Pete Cahill, I'm the Chief Judge in the 4th District and also Chair of the E-Court Steering Committee, which is more relevant to this provision. And I simply would stand for questions if there are any.
Questions from members? Seeing no questions, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Slocum, I've got a couple issues with this bill. On page 3, line 10 through 13, I have, as a former officer, the question I have, if I wrote somebody a warning violation for something defective on their vehicle or a repair tag for their vehicle, and I let them drive off, they go 2 miles down the road and crash, and it's because of that. Just because they gave a warning citation, is that officer going to be liable for anything that could happen when you're using the equipment violation as a possibility for a reason for the defective, for the injury?
Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. I'm going to refer to my testifier to answer that.
Judge Cahill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That provision is in current law. This is simply reordering it. And the intent there, as I understand it, is if a driver has been told you have a problem with this car and you should fix it, that shows their knowledge and raises it from mere negligence to maybe perhaps gross negligence or recklessness. I can't really opine on whether there is any liability for the officer. I can't imagine there would, that since we have not changed the law and simply reordered it, I'm not aware of any suits that have arisen out of that subdivision.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you.
Question?
One other question on 4.27 and 4.28, and along with 5.19 5.20. If somebody's under the influence of marijuana or THC, with when it states other than these in the, are they going to be, is the county attorneys or going to be able to charge these people that are high on marijuana for vehicular operation, criminal vehicular operation?
Judge Cahill.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, this speaks, again, it's the recodification that marijuana can stay in the system a fairly long time, might not indicate it under the influence. However, I think there are a great many officers who are trained as drug recognition experts to be able to tell if they are under the influence of a drug. And I think it's because of the long-term nature that marijuana can sometimes stay in the system, that years ago that exception was made for marijuana in the system to the zero tolerance for drugs in the system and driving.
Representative Johnson.
I understand the DREs are great people. The problem is in rural Minnesota, they're hard to come by. They're in the metro area, up in my counties that I worked in is about 45 miles straight north of Minneapolis, and there's times we waited an hour and a half for a DRE. And that can get into an unreasonable delay during the traffic stop. So I think some should probably look at something to deal with this other than just because with just that in there, I think it's a concern for me that just because of that it's in there might be a little more difficult to charge somebody out under it.
Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, Judge, are we just running into a problem this bill for this is being co-located or recodified where it's current and existing language put in another place and it's underlined, so it makes it look like new language in this bill?
Judge Cahill.
Madam Chair and Representative Cornish, yes.
Okay.
It is simply reordering. Okay. The need is to be able to pass convictions automatically and avoid human error in the manual transmission of the convictions. The language, the offenses, the penalties have not been changed.
So,
Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, Judge, then Cahill?
Yes.
Sorry. So there's nothing really in this bill that makes it any easier for criminals to get off or change anything drastically. That like it makes it look at first glance like new language, it's existing language already.
Judge Cahill.
Madam Chair, Representative Cornish, I would agree with that statement.
No.
Other questions from members? Seeing none, the chair renews the motion that House File 2928 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Slocum. I would move that House File 2574 be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Slocum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File...
Right here. 2574
deals with predatory offenders, and what this bill proposes to solve is that individuals who commit certain violent conduct are required by law to register as a predatory offender. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension maintains the central repository of information about these predatory offenders and assists local law enforcement and probationary agencies with supervision of these individuals. This proposal requests several changes to assist with this supervision and treat predatory offenders in a consistent manner. Again, this is technical. The proposal also addresses a portion of the criminal code where the description of the crime also contains the penalty for two different crimes. I'd like to introduce my testifier. My testifier is Katie Engler, and she's the senior legal analyst with the BCA.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Katie Engler with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and I will do the walkthrough of the bill for you. Section 1 makes several changes to registration requirements for predatory offenders. For example, the change in lines 1.22 and 1.23 would include all offenses in sections 609.322 and 609.324. Not just soliciting a minor to engage in prostitution or sexual conduct, but also including promoting prostitution of a minor, receiving profits from the prostitution of a minor, sex trafficking, etc. The change in line 1.24 would have all conduct related to electronic communications with a child relating to or describing sexual conduct or distributing material that relates to or describes sexual conduct be now a registerable offense. The next changes are on page 2. Right now in Minnesota, offenders who are convicted of a crime that arises out of the same set of circumstances are required to register. For example, if they are charged with criminal sexual conduct and burglary, and they plead to the burglary charge, they still are required to register. That language does not, however, exist for federal offenses and offenses committed in other states. And so the changes in 2.5 through 2.9 and 2.11 through 2.14 would make those parallel changes. And the last change in Section 1 is in line 2.27. Last year, you as a legislature recodified the chapter for people to be civilly committed as sexually dangerous or sexually psychopathic, and that is now Chapter 253D. Most of the individuals currently under civil commitment for those types of offenses were committed under one of the two predecessor statutes, either Chapter 253B or Chapter 526. And so line 2.27 is the first of several references back to those predecessor statutes. What we're attempting to do is prevent litigation from those civilly committed claiming they're no longer required to register. Section 2 only contains one of those updated cross-references. Section 3 takes us to line 5.9. First change is an update in how we capture fingerprints. They're no longer done with ink and rolled on a card, rather they're done electronically. You then have one of those predecessor cross-references, and now we're on to page 6. The language is about photographing any offender. Right now, only level 3 offenders can be photographed. Level 3 is the most risky individual. That risk assessment is done for people who have been incarcerated in a correctional facility, but they make up only 7% of the people currently registered. So we have the ability to photograph a very small subset of the totality of the offenders. And so this language would allow photographs of any offender at any level and at any time. The next change is in 6.29. This again broadens authority for people who are doing the supervision to have contact with offenders. And then we have updated or the cross-reference updates. Section 4 really begins at the top of page 8. We have one of those predecessor references. And then in 8.13, there's a change in a verb to reflect the practice that we always extend the registration requirement for people who have been convicted for failure to register. Right now, the verb is a permissive one, and that it always happens. In 8.16 and 8.17, we're changing language so that all offenders who reoffend get treated the same way. Right now, if someone is arrested and serves some time before they post bail, and then they are subsequently given credit for time served, the registration period is not extended. But if instead they serve that time after sentencing, the registration period is extended, and we're just trying to make that consistent across all offenders. Sections 5 and 6 are intertwined. Section 5 removes the language Representative Slocum referenced about the penalty being mixed in with the description of the offense. And Section 6, which is page 11, places that penalty language back in the penalty section for criminal sexual conduct in the third degree. And with that, I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, I renew the Representative McNamer.
Madam Chair, Representative Slocum. Does this address if you have a predatory offender that has to register in a state outside of Minnesota, then moves to Minnesota, he must register in Minnesota also?
Ms. Engler?
Madam Chair, Representative, no, I don't believe that is part of this bill.
Seeing no further questions, again, I will move House File 2574 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye. 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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Slocum, I need you to stay for just a minute. Members, it's my understanding that the provision that we passed out of Representative Slocum's was not the first engrossment, and we needed to be working off the first engrossment. Everyone now has a copy of the first engrossment from that first bill, Criminal Vehicular Homicide Operation. So we need to make a motion to reconsider the vote where we passed the last bill and then resend this bill as the first engrossment. So is there any objection to that? Oh, all right. Then I would move to reconsider House File 2928 that was sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Then again, I would move House File 2928, the first engrossment, the language that you have in front of you now. Any questions from members? Any concerns? All right. I would renew my motion that House File 2928 be...
Madam Chair? I'm sorry, I apologize for being a little late. Were there major differences between the first engrossment and this one, or the original bill and this? Because it seems like we're getting this and kind of making a judgment on the fly without having really read it.
Representative Slocum, do you remember the changes that you made between the first committee and the second committee? Representative Slocum.
Madam Chair.
Actually, I will have Ms. Perius tell us if that's okay.
Okay.
Ms. Perius.
Madam Chair and members, it added sections 1 through 3, which were cross-references in the DWI chapter. So it added the updated cross-references to the changes made to the CVO section numbering.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. With that, I would renew my motion that House File 2928, the first engrossment, be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Representative Schoen, are you ready? Representative Schoen, I'll move that House File 2338 be re-referred to the General Register, and it's my understanding that the A4 amendment is your amendment, Representative Schoen.
Madam Chair, correct.
I will move the A4 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Schoen to the bill.
Madam Chair and members, House File 2328 is a domestic violence bill that disarms abusers who have been convicted in a court of law. This bill will protect victims and domestic violence and stalking from gun violence and will reduce the number of women murdered with guns each year. First, I'd like to be clear about what this bill does not do, because I believe there's been some confusion. This bill does not allow the government to take guns without due process or conviction in a court of law. This bill does not allow for illegal searches and seizures, as some have suggested. The bill strengthens protections for victims of violence by removing firearms from those subject to civil orders for protection and those prohibited from possessing firearms due to a criminal conviction related to domestic abuse. Under federal law, persons convicted of a domestic violence charge are prohibited from having guns. This bill allows the state to enforce federal law and requires persons convicted of domestic violence charges to surrender their guns. The bill, in conjunction with amendments that have been brought forward on this bill as it's traveled, the bill provides that those subject to an order for protection in domestic child abuse and domestic abuse be prohibited from possessing a firearm for the length of the order, which mirrors federal law. In order for this section to apply, the bill establishes the following requirements, which also mirror federal law. The order granting relief must be issued after a hearing in which the abusing party received actual notice and at which the abusing party had the opportunity to participate. The order must, one, restrain the abusing party from harassing, stalking, or threatening the abused party, or restrain the abusing party from engaging in other conduct that would place the abused party in reasonable fear of bodily injury, including finding that the abusing party represents a credible threat to physical safety of the abused party or prohibits the abused party from using, attempting to use, or threatening physical for against the abused party. The bill adds to the list of ineligible persons under state law as a person subject to an order for protection and persons who are disqualified under federal law. The bill provides that for those individuals convicted of domestic abuse, stalking, and assault in the first degree through fifth degree, or assault by strangulation against a family or household member, and the court must order surrender of the firearms under provision of this bill. The surrender provisions under this bill and amendment are that the prohibited party must surrender their firearms within 3 business days to a federally licensed firearm dealer, a law enforcement agency, or a third party who may lawfully receive them and does not reside with the abusing party. The bill provides differing standards for firearms temporarily surrendered and those permanently surrendered. The bill requires that an abusing party must file proof of transfer with the court, and that is to a third party, such as a family member that's not living with them, a federal firearms license dealer, or even to the a law enforcement agency. I want to thank both sides of this issue for negotiating in good faith. Representative Cornish and I have had many discussions in working with the NRA and other gun groups, GOCRA, in fact. You know, it gets us further down the road. We had more work to do. The amendment that came before you today sealed up some continuing concerns that we had yesterday. And so the amendment that was put on today gives 2 extra business days for someone to submit proof that they transferred their guns. And then it allows the court to require immediate surrender to law enforcement of firearms if the abuser poses an imminent risk of substantial bodily harm to the victim. And this is something that's actually commonly done already. It allows the abuser to transfer guns that have been immediately surrendered to a third party or FFL upon written notice. And then upon transfer to a third party or FFL, the affidavit must be given to the court and must remain sealed.
Questions from members? Representative Droskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Schoen, on the amendment, on the A4 amendment, line 1.8 says imminent risk. Can you tell us where we find the definition of that and what it is?
Representative Schoen.
Madam Chair, I would probably refer to, it's in the domestic statutes for starters, but staff would probably be the best to give you the what our legal definition from the orders and related to that are.
Mr. Diebel.
Madam Chair, members, Representative Droskowski, it's not defined in the bill, and I'm not aware of a definition in statute. It would be up to the court to determine that. And I'd have to do additional research if there's case law on defining that. This would be a new context, and so it would have to be drawn whether that a definition in another case would apply in this case. I'd have to do some legal analysis of that. But this is a term given to the court to make use exercise the judgment.
Representative Droskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to see what that definition is, and apparently we don't have it. I mean, that's an important term here in regard to how the court is going to make judgment in these cases.
Representative Droskowski, why don't we let folks talk about it? Oh, Representative Paymer,
Sure.
You could talk to your microphone.
I'm not sure, Madam Chair, but I'm just wondering if Mr. Diebel knows about the under the chapters that deal with self-defense, if that language isn't used and defined.
While we let staff look it up for a while, why don't we take the testifiers that want to testify on the bill, if that's okay, Representative Droskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Schoen, do you have any testifiers?
Yes, ma'am.
Welcome to the committee. Please come down if you plan to testify. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is Sarah Gruing, and I'm the St. Paul City Attorney. On behalf of myself and Ramsey County Attorney John Choi, who is unable to join us today, I am pleased to be with you this afternoon in support of House File 3238. My office handles roughly 1,000 misdemeanor and gross misdemeanor cases of domestic abuse every year, and the Ramsey County Attorney's Office handles more than 800 juvenile and gross misdemeanor cases in Ramsey County. Together, we are united in this community around a set of protocols called the St. Paul Blueprint for Safety. The blueprint establishes our system's response to domestic violence from that first 911 operator who takes the call all the way through to probation. The Blueprint for Safety is our interagency effort to prevent domestic homicide in the same way that legislative efforts like these will ultimately save lives. In St. Paul, we have witnessed firsthand the havoc that domestic violence brings to our community, to our friends, and to our family members. We've also witnessed firsthand the toxic mixture of domestic violence and firearms. It is our experience that guns make domestic violence more terrifying. Firearms are an instrument of torture in relationships involving domestic abuse. All too often, our victims report that their perpetrator, that the guns perpetuated their abuser's cycle of power and control, that she was told time and time again that he would kill her or her children if she left, and the presence of a weapon in that home made that threat not just possible, but highly likely. We frequently see phrases in petitions for orders for protection in Ramsey County like, he has a gun and I am scared. Guns always also make domestic violence more deadly. As you know, a woman is 6 times more likely to be killed in a domestic violence incident if there are guns present in her home. The combination of domestic violence and guns affects the entire community. Nearly 60% of all mass shootings, including the one that happened at a spa in Brookfield, Wisconsin 2 years ago, where 8 people were killed, involved the killing of a family member or current or former intimate partner of the shooter. Furthermore, if Chief Tom Smith were here, he would tell you that domestic calls are often considered the most dangerous calls that police officers take. A recent 15-year study showed that 14% of all officers killed in the line of duty were responding to a domestic, and 97% of those officers were killed with a gun. Domestic violence makes up the largest category of calls to which police respond. When the perpetrator is armed, not only is the victim at much greater risk of serious harm or death, but so is the responding police officer. And as you all know, we set a heartbreaking record in Minnesota last year, with at least 38 people killed by domestic violence in 2013, 10 of whom were murdered by gunshots. 12 women were killed by a domestic abuser with a gun in 2011, and 7 were killed by a domestic abuser with a gun in 2012. As such, I am pleased to support House File 3238 and the effort to limit the possession of weapons for those who abuse children, who harass or stalk their significant others, and who make them in fear for their lives. We know that it is not a panacea and that some people will still obtain weapons through illegal means, but House File 3238 is an important and crucial step that you all can take this afternoon to better protect victims, their families, and the entire community. Those who commit the crime of domestic violence have proven themselves to be a serious risk to their wives and girlfriends, to their children, and to society as a whole, and they should be prohibited from possessing guns. I have no doubt that this legislation will save the lives of Minnesotans, and I'm honored to have the opportunity to share my thoughts with you this afternoon.
Thank you. Representative Schoen, your next testifier. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carol Arthur. I'm the Executive Director of the Domestic Abuse Project in Minneapolis. DAP provides therapy programs for men who are abusive, for women and children who are victims of domestic violence. We have proactive advocacy, support, and assistance provided to all victims identified by the Minneapolis Police arrest and gun on arrival domestic assault reports. We serve more than 3,000 men, women, and children a year at DAP. I'm testifying in support of House File 3238. As you've heard, domestic violence is an issue that affects 1 in 3 women in this country. In 2012, over 63,000 Minnesotans sought services from domestic violence programs, yet we know only 1 in 5 victims will seek services. In 2013, as has been mentioned, we experienced 38 domestic violence homicides in our state, and over the past 3 years, 90 Minnesotans have been killed in domestic violence murders, 50% of them with firearms. Minnesota has been a leader nationally and internationally at creating concrete solutions to domestic violence problems. In Hennepin and Ramsey counties and in other communities across our state, law enforcement is starting to do risk assessments at the scene of domestics to identify those cases that are most at risk of escalating to increased violence, potentially to murder. Let me share 3 of the most common questions used in those risk or danger assessments. Has the physical violence increased in severity over the past year, and/or has a weapon or threat from a weapon ever been used? Is there a firearm in the house? Does he threaten to kill you, and/or do you believe he is capable of killing you? These questions have been tested in numerous reliability and validity studies as being able to help identify those victims at increased risk. In the most recent study comparing risk factors among abused women and abused murder victims, The study found that women who were threatened or assaulted with a firearm were 20 times more likely than other women to be murdered. Women whose partners threatened them with murder were 15 times more likely than other women to be killed. And when a firearm was simply in the house, an abused woman was 6 times more likely to be killed. Clearly, there is a high correlation between firearms and domestic homicide. I'd like to share the story of Pamela Tussock, a 48-year-old juvenile probation officer who was murdered by her husband, Alan, in 2009. A woman this legislation might have helped. In 2 months prior to her death, Pam did everything she could to protect herself from her abusive husband. Over their 23-year marriage, he had hit, punched, pushed, and held her captive many, many times and had threatened to kill her on at least 4 occasions. On August 26th, after he bloodied her nose and split her lip, Alan was arrested for domestic assault and false imprisonment. This was the most recent of 22 domestic assault police calls to her home. 2 days later, he was released from jail without conditions because he had posted $5,000 bail. He told Pam he asked for bail so he would not have to have any conditions, particularly he wouldn't have to have a condition of no contact with her. Pam sought and was granted an order for protection on September 10th, then filed for divorce on September 25th. On October 1st, after she returned to her home from a support group meeting at a battered women's shelter, Alan came to her door, and when she opened the door, he shot her, called 911, and shot himself. The current bill that would require the surrender of all firearms in cases where courts have issued an order for protection might have prevented this homicide. This bill is a small change that will have a significant impact on the safety of domestic violence victims and their families. To ensure their basic right to be safe, including in their own home, I urge you to support House File 3238, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Representative Schoen, how many testifiers do you have? We want to make sure that we give equal time for anyone that might want to be opposed.
Chief Schnell, the last one.
All right. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Schnell. I'm the Chief of Police for the City of Maplewood, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, who stand in support of this bill. And I will keep my comments very short. As has been well documented by the previous testifiers, we know that there is clear evidence and data that suggests that anytime weapons are present with batterers and abusers, there is a much higher level of risk of domestic homicide as well as risk to officers responding to those incidents. We believe in our review of this bill as presented that it does and will provide for the protection of women and children in our communities, and we stand in support of it. We believe that that the provisions laid out in the bill do allow us to provide for the safety of weapons and a range of options for those people making both temporary and permanent transfers, and believe that ultimately this will create safer communities. I thank you on behalf of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association for your consideration of this bill, and we urge you to support House File 3238.
Thank you. Representative Schoen, anything else? All right. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? If you want to testify, please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Good afternoon. Madam Chair, members, thank you very much. My name is Andrew Rothman. I am the president of Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance. I want to thank Representative Schoen for his diligence in removing the infringing elements contained in this bill when it was sent from Bloomberg headquarters in New York. We know that domestic abuse is a serious issue in Minnesota and around the country, and the 2 million law-abiding gun owners in Minnesota hold these cowards, these abusers, in utter contempt. Nonetheless, we do maintain that this bill is largely duplicative, redundant, and superfluous given the restrictions already contained in the federal law in the Wellstone Amendment, as a matter of fact, championed by Minnesota's own Senator Paul Wellstone. In the heartbreaking story of Alan and Pam that you just heard about, the law did not fail this victim of domestic abuse. Minnesota Statute 629.715, as every good prosecutor knows, already empowers judges to impose conditions of release, including the immediate removal of firearms from the home. It is absolutely tragic that after decades of abuse that this didn't take place. But if a judge chooses not to impose that condition of release, the judge could equally impose not to impose this order for protection in such a way that it would trigger this removal of firearms. But more broadly, I'm concerned with this fixation on hardware. As you heard from previous testifiers, 10 of the 38 murders related to domestic abuse last year involved firearms, 26%. The other 74% didn't. Now, if you look at the Department of Public Safety's numbers for homicides throughout the state, we find that 71% of homicides in the state involve firearms. So a domestic murder is actually only a third as likely as any other kind of murder to involve a firearm at all. Firearms aren't instruments of torture. Causing someone's immediate death is not torture, and an abuser's MO, an abuser's intent is to cause fear, to cause pain, and to cause suffering, not to end it. The notion that the guns perpetuate the cycle of violence doesn't make any sense. And I've been asked by several people in relation to the ship to this bill, when the order involves the removal of firearms from the home, which might make some difference in these 10 homicides, are they going to remove the baseball bats and the knives and the fists and boots from the abusers as well? We have a real problem with somebody who poses that sort of danger, who is actually let loose on our streets. I think rather than spending time worrying about the hardware, worrying about the firearms, I think this committee and this body's time could be better spent in looking what needs to be done to change the hearts and the minds, or at least to lock up safely away from civilized people these abusers in the first place.
Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify for or against this bill?
Madam Chair, members, Jim Franklin with the Sheriff's Association. I want to thank Representative Schoen for the work that's been done in this and all the people that have collaborated. Yesterday we had questions about it. Many of those questions have been addressed. I'd like to have this bill move forward. There are a couple of things that we want to have a little bit more clarity on, but I'm sure we're going to be able to work those out. The general concept of what's here, we certainly support, endorse, and want to try to move forward. So with that, I'll just conclude.
Thank you. Okay, it's my understanding that staff could give us a report potentially on the question that was asked by Representative Ruskowski. Mr. Devo.
Madam Chair, members, as I said in my original response, it's not defined in statute. It's used elsewhere in statute. For example, in 245C.17, it directs the Commissioner of Human Services, when they're doing background studies, to determine if someone is an imminent risk to those that they interact with in their professional capacity, and then they put restrictions on them, but it doesn't define imminent risk. It's left to the commissioner to determine. So it would require, to determine how the courts interpret imminent risk, would require a case law research to determine what elements they look for. It is, a similar term is used in Chapter 518B, which is the domestic abuse statute, where it refers to imminent physical harm, bodily injury, or assault. And so I suspect that it's probably been interpreted through case law, but it's not defined in statute.
Thank you. Representative Ruskowski, follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Diebel. You know, I would rather have the legislature developing a definition for imminent risk than a judge. As we look at this particular bill, I see another term here on 2.23 of the bill, credible threat, and I'm curious as to whether or not that term has a definition in statute as well. So it appears to me that this bill still needs more work, Madam Chair, And I don't know if we need Mr. Diebel to answer that question too or not, but it's in the same vein. You know, it might make sense to lay this bill over and come back and take a look at it next week.
Any other questions from members? Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Schoen, I myself have served many of these harassment restraining orders and the ex parte orders and the temporary orders. But you have a term in here that I've never seen before on these orders. You actually have two terms. I think would make this more clear as to who's responsible for what on these orders. In your bill, you have abusing party 13 times and abused party 4 times, just in one paragraph. On the orders, it's either the respondent or the petitioner. And I think it'd be more clear and more understandable and line up better with the orders if you change those words to match the words on the order.
Representative Schoen?
No, I don't. Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, I don't find fault with your logic there. I think that that's something that we could do even before we get to the floor. I think those are those would be appropriate terms to put into place.
I believe there's one last testifier who wanted to speak. Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
My name is Chad Nelson. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. In my review of this bill, I've come across a few 800-pound gorillas in the room that nobody seems to want to address. And some of it's policy, procedure-type things that maybe somebody not familiar with the system may not understand. First of all and foremost, when you're in the system, and first of all, I'd like to say domestic violence is a terrible thing. It shouldn't be tolerated. Abusers should be handled appropriately and so forth, and it's a terrible thing. But I don't hear anything or anybody talking about the times where you're falsely accused, but I'll get to that in a second. If there's a domestic violence situation, chances are there's going to be charges filed, criminal charges, domestic assault, domestic something assault under those provisions. And if there's an order for protection or restraining order, the order that it comes up is your restraining order or protective order will come up first before your case can get properly adjudicated in the courts, which means, in my experience, when you go to your restraining order hearing or your protective order hearing, your hands are absolutely tied because of your criminal pending case. So you are likely to go neutral and accept the no contact order just to prepare yourself in the best possible position for your criminal case. So here you are potentially as an accused individual being passive on a no contact order, and then a provision in this bill automatically provides you and labels you prohibited from owning firearms. That's absurd. Your due process at that point is not taken care of. And at that point, when you go to court at your first appearance in this domestic violence order or restraining order, at that particular moment in time, the court has the opportunity to check that box. No firearms. There's a box that they can check or choose not to check if it's not appropriate. If this bill passes as it stands, someone would have to be passive on an unadjudicated case, and then their firearms rights are potentially gone on a case that's not even adjudicated that could possibly go away in the criminal proceedings that were to come. So potentially your case could be completely adjudicated in the criminal side, and now you're a prohibited person because you had to be passive on the original no contact order before your criminal case is decided. That's fundamentally a problem with this bill as it is. Briefly, I had the opportunity to take care of my mother for 4 years in my house as a caregiver. someone who had Alzheimer's and dementia issues. It's not easy to say no to your mother. Those of you that have taken care of family members, I'm sure you can agree. To make long story short, one day my mother called police and accused me of abuse. It was terribly heartbreaking. The first appearance or contact with the court realized that there's dementia and Alzheimer's issues in my house. The original judge said, go home and take care of your mother. Looked at the file, looked at the abuse allegations, and said, go home and take care of your mother. But what happens is, when there's an abuse claim, Adult Protective Services gets involved, and now you're in a big, huge mess of bureaucracy that, unless if you've ever experienced it, you can not possibly imagine what you're up against. Adult Protective Services, for a week, worked on my mother to try to get her to sign and to buy into a no-contact order and a restraining order, and my mother said no. She even went so far as to recant her story. But Adult Protective Services wouldn't have any part of that. My mother called me to take her home from the hospital, and I picked her up and to take her home. When I got home, there's a police presence at my house that would rival anything that you'd see on TV. So obviously, the police at my house did not get the memo from the original judge that said, go home and take care of your mother. I cooperated with authorities. Later on, when things settled down, my mother came home. We called the police, told them we were fine. They came to my house. What Adult Protective Services did then shocked me. They went to a different judge in a different court, declared my mother a vulnerable adult, forced her into a restraining order or a non-protective contact order that she did not want, and then ordered the no-contact order, took her out of my house. The no-contact order is in place that she didn't want, and now she's under protective custody, and I haven't seen her since November. When the restraining order came up for court, it came up before the charges that came up for adjudication. And exactly what I just mentioned happened to me. I had to be passive in my no contact order situation because my criminal case was pending. Fast forward to the criminal case, the charges were dismissed. The domestic violence, the domestic assault were dismissed. But now I've got this no contact order from my own mother for 2 years because Adult Protective Services got involved and forced a restraining order and a no protective order on my mother that my mother did not want. I have a few solutions. And a few things, and I know time is important. It was mentioned that if this bill passes, that you will have 3 business days to dispose of your firearms. I guarantee you that if you get that letter, that you have 3 days to dispose of your firearms. On the 4th day, law enforcement will be at your door with a court-ordered search warrant to search your house for weapons that you may or may not have. And if there's no database, and you're in a situation where there may or may not be weapons, but you're now a prohibited person, you're going to have, and I believe that could be an unintended consequence to this bill.
You've got about a minute and a half
okay.
left.
Okay, thank you, Chair, Madam Chair. I would like to see stronger penalties for people that make false claims. There are plenty of valid claims of abuse and domestic violence, but an order of protection or a restraining order can also be used as a weapon in of itself. 2 people getting divorced, a relationship is ending, one files a restraining order against the other, and now they move on with their life, they get on living separate places, but because a judge orders a no contact order, that person that's moved on with their life is prohibited from owning or possessing weapons? That's absurd. An order of protection on his face is not a crime. It's an allegation of fear or whatever. The other thing I'd like to see is I'd like to see a prohibition of forced restraining orders when it's clear the restraining order person that's labeled, say, a vulnerable adult, to stop forced restraining orders on someone who doesn't want it. And I think the only difference sometimes between the difference between the petitioner, as you mentioned, sir, and the respondent is who shows up to the court first. People are getting divorced. They make allegations. Who's going to file the restraining order, the protective order first? The one that shows up first is in the driver's seat. The other one is really far behind. The other thing I'd like to say in closing is I think it might prevent false claims is if a person is going to file a false claim in a restraining order or protective order situation, have both parties subject to that restraining order both give up their firearms. If both people give up their firearms in a restraining order or protective order situation, then it can be less likely be used as a weapon against the other. Mm-hmm. So if you consider some of the provisions that I brought forth, if this bill would be passed, like I said, I do believe domestic violence is a very bad thing. It should not be condoned. But we need to provide for provisions for people that are falsely accused as well.
Thank you. Questions from members? Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Where did he go? I have a question to the gentleman. And I didn't get your name.
Sir, my name is Chad Nelson.
Mr. Nelson.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you. How is it that you were led to believe that you were forced to be passive in the hearing on the OFP?
Mr. Nelson.
I was advised and in counsel with the court when Adult Protective Service was involved and the order up for protection comes up first, that if you try to fight the no contact order at that moment in time, mm-hmm. your Fifth Amendment rights come into play on self-incrimination. If you were to say something that you shouldn't say, something that's, if you misrepresent a fact or get a fact wrong, and then you go to court and it goes to trial or something can be taken out of context. When you're fighting the, mm-hmm. the no contact order in of itself, you really put yourself in jeopardy by making statements or making factual accountings of something that could come back and not be totally accurate or not as accurate as you would like when it comes to the criminal side of the case. Does that answer your question?
Okay. And Madam Chair, I think it does. And I'm desperately searching for something in the recesses of my brain that believes that there was a provision in Minnesota Rules of Criminal Procedure that obviates that, but I don't recall. So if there's any in the audience who can confirm that, whereby you would not be cross-examined on those, I'd appreciate it. A little phone a friend. But I have one other question, Madam Chair.
Of who? Representative Lesh.
Mr. Nelson, you say that you went to pick up your mother at the hospital. Was your mother in the hospital as the result of the incident in which the police were originally called?
I'm glad you asked,
Mr.
that,
Nelson.
Sir. Absolutely not. When the judge ordered that I go home and take care of my mother was already released from the hospital with an examination from head to toe, CAT scans and X-rays and everything. There's a remark in the record that says the condition of her body was unremarkable in the lack of marks on her body, which indicated absolutely no evidence of abuse whatsoever.
Okay. Thank you. Madam Chair, and I appreciate that clarification, Mr. Nelson. I don't have any other questions.
Sir, can I clarify something on that? Because I think...
Mr. Nelson, Representative Lesh was still talking, so Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There was a helpful friend who was able to pull up Subdivision 15 of 518B, whereby in that OFP hearing, they can't use any of that testimony that you make, Mr. Nelson, against you in a subsequent domestic assault proceeding or prosecution. So I think you were misled on that. But I think that's the importance of this provision. There's a reason it's in here like that, and also why absolutely, if you're innocent, you should challenge an OFP at the time. And I guess I think that provides enough safety for any individual who is accused of this and whose rights in contesting an OFP should not be chilled because of the fears that you mentioned. And I think you are absolutely right about that. But I think the law does provide adequate remedy for that. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Scott had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that I think it's in this committee we're going to hear about people that were falsely accused being exonerated, and I know those occasions are rare, but and that's for, you know, larger offenses, felonies and that sort of thing that sends people off to prison. But you know, I just don't think this bill's quite ready. I think there are some real issues that need to be resolved here, especially with the false accusations. You know, as most of you know, I've worked pretty hard on the shared parenting issue, and it's one of the biggest hurdles we have. And is the false accusations can be made, an OFP can be issued, and it restricts even contact with children. I'm going on and on here, but what it really does in the long run, when false allegations are made and these OFPs are filed, is it's really it gives true domestic violence a bad eye, because it delegitimizes true domestic violence. And I have a real problem with this bill not addressing that particular issue, where innocent people could have their Second Amendment rights taken away from them because of something that someone said.
Representative Cornish, did you want to speak?
Madam Chair and Representative Schoen, I think there's problems with the bill too, but I want it to progress. You've been amenable to changes so far, and I'm sure you'll keep working on it on the House floor. But, sir, I don't think there's anything that we can do to take care of all the problems. The falsely accused, it's always going to happen. There's no way we can get into the minds and stop that from happening. And while I'm not shouting accolades about the bill either, I appreciate Representative Schoen what he's done so far with it. But there's no way to stop false accusations in the future, no matter what we do. Somebody could always get mad, injure themselves, and make a false accusation and send it to court. And I think there's no perfect system here, but we're doing as good as we can on this thing right now. So.
Thank you. Any other members? Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I, Madam Chair, don't like to disagree with my colleagues and those in my own party, but Representative Cornish, or Representative Lesh, of course. You know, false accusations is an area we need to deal with, and Representative Scott's absolutely right, and Mr. Nelson, you hit a spot that is right on target, and that's not probably within the context of this bill here today, but certainly it's something this legislature needs to grapple with, and we need to have some consequences for people who file false allegations of domestic violence, and it's really brought to light and evident in this bill and your testimony today, so I appreciate that. Madam Chair, the concerns that Representatives Johnson and Scott and I brought up, I would hope, Representative Schoen, that you'll work with us on some of these concerns we brought up as it moves forward, and I struggle with the bill too, because I don't think we need this bill. I know the votes are here today to pass it, but like Representative Cornish said, I understand that you've been very amenable to working with the opposition on fixing some of those things, so I appreciate that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, the Chair renews her motion that House File 3238 as amended be referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Schoen. Representative Lesh, we're going to pass on you for a minute because you're on the committee, and we're going to go to Representative Allen if she's still in the room. Representative Allen? Members, we're going to try to keep going as long as we can to try to get through this agenda. So, Representative Allen, The chair will move House File 3027 be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Allen, keep in mind that this is the Judiciary Committee. We don't want to hear about the whole bill. We only want to hear about the narrow provisions that apply to this committee. So, Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill makes technical changes to the North Star Care for Children program that it's administered by the Children and Family Services within the Department of Health Services, Department of Human Services. And I have a testifier here from the department who can go through the technical changes.
Welcome to the committee. Please keep your comments really to the sections that are within the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, my name is John Sellen. I'm an area manager at Hennepin County and serving at the Department of Human Services as project lead for North Star Care for Children. We're currently looking at House File 3027. There's a more extensive bill subsequent that covers more provisions. I'll try to keep them separate.
We're not hearing that other provision, that other bill. We're only hearing this one, I think. Yeah.
Madam Chair, if I can clarify.
Representative Allen.
You have a bill brief where it has three articles, and the bill before you is Article 1 in its entirety. So,
thank you, Representative Allen. Mr. Sellen.
Madam Chair, members, I think the area that would probably be of most interest to this committee is the background study section, which is Section 5. In Section 5, it adds the federally required background study requirements. North Star Care for Children makes extensive use of Title 4E in equalizing benefits for foster care, for relative care, and adoption assistance. And again, that's Section 5 of Article 1.
Representative Allen, is this the same as Representative Huntley's bill that's here?
Madam Chair, no, it is not.
Okay.
It's separate.
Okay, please continue, Mr. Sellen.
Madam Chair, if I might clarify your question, Representative Huntley's bill also includes provisions, including some overlapping provisions dealing with North Star Care for Children, but it's much more extensive. Because there were fiscal impacts, those are included in Representative Huntley's bill, 3215.
So once the background study is done, if we could just cut to the portion that's determined by the court. This is really about placement of children and what the court determines or uses when they're determining who they can be placed with. So we heard in civil law that there was some concern in another bill when it's the background study and exclusion of family members who want to be taking in these children. So is that in this bill? Mr. Sellen?
Madam Chair, no, that is not in this bill.
Okay, so is there anything that impacts in this bill when a court makes the determination of where a child is going? Is that what's in this bill?
Madam Chair, to the best of my knowledge, there is nothing in this bill that would affect how a court would proceed.
Okay. All right, so please continue.
Madam Chair, I think that's the main section that might be of interest to this committee. If you can identify other sections, I'd be delighted to talk about them.
So it's my understanding that in Section 12, there's really the custody to relatives is what I'm looking at the article or the bill brief. In Article 12, it says custody to relatives. It amends 60C.515 Subdivision 4, lists the requirements for a transfer of permanent legal and physical custody to a relative, the factors that a court is to consider.
Madam Chair, are you referring to Section 12?
That's what it says, Section 12. Oh, this one. A2 amendment? Is that not? We could have just a second. We're looking at the bill brief provided by House Research. I just want to make sure that we're looking at the right one.
Madam Chair, I think it's possible that I can clarify this. If you look at the bill summary, the header identifies this as a version as amended by the A2 amendment, which was not put on.
It was not put on. Okay. All right. So that's not a change that you're going to make in this bill?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
All right. Any questions from members then? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm unclear on why this is here. If we're not going to deal with that section, first of all, I don't see that delineated in the bill that we have in front of us. And so then I'm not sure, or you're not sure, that this other section that the testifier is pointing out even applies to our committee. Should this be re-referred, or the section 12 that you alluded to that was an amendment, are we missing that? Was it added in another committee? It was not. Okay.
Representative Scott, it's my understanding after consultation that it was not added in the previous committee. I'm just looking here to make sure. Section 7 has tribal court.
All right.
And it says also line 6.20 talks about tribal social service agencies prior to the issuance of a court order transferring the child's guardianship.
Okay.
So are there any questions from members about those provisions? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Just so we see if there's any controversy surrounding it. All right. Are there any questions from members? All right. Anything else that you'd like to add, Representative Allen?
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, that she asked a question about the amendment, and that was, I just want to clarify, that was withdrawn.
All right. Seeing no further questions, the Chair will renew the motion that House File 3027 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Allen.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Huntley, because we're on the topic, are you in the room? Let's keep going in the same general subject matter. Members, it was an oversight that this bill was not listed on the agenda. It was listed on the website. We had talked to other folks, but it just was inadvertently left off the agenda that was posted in the back. So, Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair, House File 3216 is the Governor's Health and Human Services Finance Bill. I think the part that this committee is interested in is Article 3, starting on page 23, and that relates to what's called a North Star Care Program for Children. And we have an amendment that would, I think, get rid of most of the problems.
And hopefully it will get rid of most of the problems and then be able to quickly move this bill on its way. So, Representative Huntley, tell us about the amendment.
The amendment, there are two things to think about in this section of the bill. One is the judge making decisions about where this children, who's going to adopt this kid. And one of the things the amendment does makes clear that is not changed. The judge still makes the decision as to who's going to adopt this kid. But there's another part in there, and that's basically federal money that goes for adoption assistance. And they have different rules. What this amendment does is make clear that it's the judge's decision and about where the kid's going, but we have to obey the federal law on moving the money with the kid. And we have people here to answer that.
Great. So basically, members, we heard this in civil law, and there was some questions about whether or not this changed the standard for qualification of whether or not a child could be placed with a family based on the licensing by DHS. And then this is making it clear that the court, it's really about the money. So whether or not you're eligible to get the money, the court can still determine that the family is eligible. Is that correct, Representative?
Yes, and we heard a case where a grandmother wanted to adopt her kid, but the grandmother had a check forgery
conviction. So the background check would have eliminated her from being the adopted one.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, Representative Huntley, do your testifiers want to answer questions or they want to testify to the subject matter? Ms. Hugdahl, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Melinda Hugdahl from Legal Aid. There are two pieces of this, as Representative Huntley indicated, and I'll quickly kind of walk through the amendment that you're looking at, the A2. The kinship agreement is going to deal with, essentially, they're doing a transfer of legal custody to a relative. They're going to be doing that with relative or kinship assistance or without it. So we kind of are setting up a separate track for doing that with the amendment, but it doesn't prohibit the court from doing the placement. It's just having the relative, after the records today, have a point to make some choices about how that might work. I think the operative piece for the committee, which was the substantive change to the statute about transfer of legal custody and the court's authority, is really line 7 of the amendment, which is, where's that piece? On page 42, lines 18 and 19, deleting the new language. That was where the substantive change in the transfer legal custody statute was. We took that language out. There is some other new language that deals with the kinship placement agreements, which is really getting to whether the relative is going to receive kinship assistance or not as part of the transfer of legal custody. But it's a separate, the judge will have an agreement regardless whether they receive assistance or not. It's just that it doesn't impact the ability to do the placement.
So, members, the reason this bill was here is because it was modifying the court's ability to make these determinations, and it was sending it to the DHS background study. I believe that with this change, it keeps it back in the court system. Any questions from members?
Madam Chair.
Representative Portman.
Has the bill been moved?
It has not yet been moved. It's going to your committee, right? Correct, Representative Huntley? So, yes, House File 3215.
I would move that the bill, House File 3215 be re-referred, and I would offer the A2 amendment.
Representative Portman moves the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Portman renews her motion that House File 3215 be re-referred to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Hall.
Thank you, Chairman and members.
Next we have Representative Johnson. Is there anyone on your testifiers that has to go right away? Or okay. All right. So, Representative Seltzer, are you still here? Representative Seltzer, do you have the A4 amendment to get the bill in the shape you would like it? Representative Seltzer?
Yes, I do, Madam Chair.
All right. The Chair would move House File 2481, and it's to go to the General Register, and I would move the A4 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevail. Representative Seltzer, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Hillstrom, and I will keep this brief because I know time.
Have Seltzer to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Hillstrom, and I will keep this brief because I know time is of the essence. This bill is the Department of Public Safety initiative, as statute directs the Department of Public Safety as having the primary responsibility for school transportation safety. The two primary reasons that this bill was drafted was in response to significant safety concerns regarding our children on school buses. One is due to children being left unattended and forgotten on school buses, often in extreme temperatures. And number two is known incidences where school buses have been inspected and placed out of service for unsafe equipment, yet the school buses were put back into service and used for pupil transportation without any repair or corrective action taken, jeopardizing the safety of children. And so this does deal with this bill. I just want to mention also does deal with type three vehicles, which are the vehicles that, and there should be a picture in your handouts. These are the vehicles that generally transport our special education and our Head Start children, and they usually have 10 or fewer drivers. So I will just draw your attentions to the portions of this bill that would be of interest to this committee. One is a criminal, if you look in Section 4, a criminal offense to require or allow operation of an out-of-school bus is now a gross misdemeanor. Currently, this is not a violation. If you look in Section 7, this also requires a Type 3 driver to report a loss of driving privileges to their employer to ensure they're not operating a Type 3 vehicle without a valid license. So this would be a misdemeanor, and this language mirrors the statutory language requirements of larger school bus drivers. And then finally, what might be of interest to the committee is in Section 9, it does identify the administrative sanction, the action of a one-year disqualification to the school bus endorsement of the driver if the court determines the driver failed to complete an interior post-trip inspection of the bus to ensure no student or students are left unattended, and the result is that there is a child that has been left on the in the school bus. So that's just a very quick summary of the areas that would be of interest to this committee. And I also have with me Major Nancy Silke and Lieutenant Brian Rue from the Department of Public Safety.
So are you planning to testify or just answer questions?
Madam Chair, Nancy Silke with the State Patrol. We're just available for questions.
All right, questions from members. Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Seltzer, if I remember right, a Type 3 school bus, and we now have licensing requirements for volunteers, parents, and others around a Type 3 school bus, which can include vans and cars and other types of normal vehicles that we all drive. Is that what we're talking about here? We're not talking about the yellow buses, are we?
Representative Seltzer.
There are some Type 3 are smaller yellow buses. However, this, my understanding is, and I will defer to Major Silke or Lieutenant Rue, but this refers to not volunteers, but to actual employees driving these. So there are Type 3 buses. There is a picture in your handout, which shows you. It's like a smaller school bus.
Madam Chair.
I don't think we have that, Madam Chair.
Cool. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Lieutenant Brian with the State Patrol. Madam Chair, Representative, other members, the Type 3 is the non-yellow school bus or the non-yellow vehicle, so your minivans or passenger cars that the school district or company might use to transport smaller number of children. So it's the passenger vehicles is what the Type 3 is.
Representative Lesh, did you have a question? No, Representative Moline.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Seltzer, who exactly is subject to the prosecution of the gross misdemeanor that's being added in line 1.23?
Who would like to answer that question? Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Malin and members of the committee, that ultimately would come down to whoever made the determination to put that vehicle back into service without the repairs being done. So if it's at a random location inspection, at an event, we put the bus out of service and the driver makes that determination that we're taking this vehicle to get the kids home, and our investigation would show that it was a driver, then we would charge the driver, file it through the court, submit our reports for potential charging and go for the driver. If it's an annual inspection and the maintenance supervisor, whoever it is at the terminal or facility, determines we don't have the parts to fix it, we're going to use it anyway. That really all comes through our investigation and reporting procedures.
Representative Moline.
Madam Chair, I guess just that seems unusual to me that a employee of a company could be subject to a criminal prosecution because their employer has a vehicle that's not up to code or is in violation, and then to then prosecute an employee. From my understanding, that's what could happen under this situation, that an employee of a company could actually be prosecuted.
Lieutenant Rue?
Madam Chair, Representative and members, that's correct. If that employee was the one that intentionally took that vehicle that they knew was out of service and put it back into use without having knowing the repairs were done.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Drazkowski.
Madam Chair, I'm wondering if Representative Seltzer, if you could review Section 6 with us again. So this van or this car that everybody has one at home or knows of somebody that has one, we are apparently the schools require or statute requires, that they inspect inside to make sure there's nothing dangerous in the car or van or something like that, and then we're going to apply a misdemeanor if they fail to do that inspection. Can you tell us more about that again?
The post
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The post-trip inspection, if I understand your question correctly, Representative, the post-trip inspection is just looking inside to make sure all the children are out, that we don't have any children left on the bus. There have been several instances where children have been left on the bus in the cold.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Seltzer, how do we know whether they look to? It seems to me most people who look after kids in a school and when they're driving a car or a van to an event and back or whatever they're using it for, are probably going to look in the car and van and make sure the kids are out. Again, these are cars or vans, and we're going to apply a misdemeanor for. Somebody to potentially allege that somebody did something wrong. So I'm curious more about how is this proven that they didn't look to the back of the car or van, which is about a quarter turn of your head, as I understand, in those vehicles.
Representative Seltzer?
May I defer to Major Silkey? She would like to respond.
Madam Chair, Representative, the provision that you're looking at in Section 6, there's a amendment that goes with that on line 1.16 of the A4 amendment. That amendment adds the language of any known violation, and I would just also add that the language is stricken in regards to it being a misdemeanor. The friendly amendment that we do have here on the A4 lines 1.16 and 1.17 articulate that section 169.89 does not apply to a violation of this subdivision. And basically what that statute refers to is any violations under Chapter 169, if they're not so identified, become a petty misdemeanor. So in this particular case, this is not a petty misdemeanor. It's not a misdemeanor. It's basically creates a mandatory reporting situation where we request that if there is a known violation where a child was left on the bus, that the language then asks that known violation be reported to the Director of Pupil Transportation, as typically we only learn of the information from a parent or the media.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. So it sounds to me like the criminal penalty is gone and there's not even a petty misdemeanor there existing now with the amendment, as I understand it. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's correct.
All right. Other questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Kelleher. I'm here representing the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association, and I'll be as quick and as brief as possible given the constraints of the committee. So I'll just sort of cut to the chase. Last year, the school bus operators came before this committee to raise the fine for crossing arm violations, and this committee chose not to do that. This year, the committee is being asked to create a one-year suspension of an S endorsement for school bus drivers for a violation of leaving a child unattended on a bus. It's primarily the language on page 6 of the bill itself. We've been working with the State Patrol, which is most, but not all, of our concerns are addressed in the A4 amendment. But the huge sticking point is this one-year suspension of the license. The School Bus Operators Association has suggested a higher fine, very large fine, with funds going to the school bus safety account, which would put it in Lieutenant Rue's Office of Pupil Transportation Safety. We're having enough trouble hiring drivers today in a lot of parts of rural Minnesota. It's expensive to train, recruitment is very difficult, and we now have to tell them that you get a gross misdemeanor for leaving a child unattended on a bus. And even though there is this time frame of the 50 feet visible sight of the bus and 10 minutes after you've gotten off the bus. And that was at our request because we sort of were thinking about, well, I mean, at what quick parameter or time frame are you off the bus and you still haven't checked? You know, and the larger concern, too, is that there's no due process in regards to this penalty of the gross misdemeanor. If you look in the amendment, the A4 amendment, on line 1.13, the court shall ensure that section 63.40 subdivision A is complied with. I didn't know what that was. I had to look it up. And what this is the kind of the language on certified copy of disqualifying offense conviction sent to public safety in all school districts. It's similar to that. But there's no due process to that. But the subdivision right above it has some due process language, which we would really love to have in effect. And then I suppose this is the last thing I'd say. Yesterday, I spoke with the Hennepin County Sheriff and asked him about what about parents leaving their children unattended in a car? What's the penalty, the fine for that? And he said, more than likely a tongue lashing, a stern lecture from the law enforcement officer. If it's a really egregious violation, heat, cold, length of time, you know, and he really didn't say what length of time would be, that it would probably be reported also to Child Services. But there's no automatic penalty, there's no automatic fine, those sorts of things. So I think we're asking the committee to sort of look at this one-year suspension. We think it's really a long time, and will further make it difficult for us to find drivers to drive our buses. Certainly we understand the severity and the tragic nature of leaving children unattended on a bus.
Representative Draskowski, then Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Mr. Kelleher, maybe Representative Seltzer or others, Section 2 of the bill, again, and Mr. Kelleher was talking about it, a gross misdemeanor if a child is left unattended on a school bus. Now, is this the Type 3 school bus, the car or the van, or is this a yellow one?
Madam Chair, it's my understanding that these are the all the yellow buses. That I think you have a picture before you of the types of buses. Well, there's 7 categories of different types of buses, and they're basically most of the yellow ones that say school bus on the top. So it's those types of vehicles.
Representative Draskowski, follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and staff advised that the gross misdemeanor is gone in the bill. It's a petty no. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Keller, do most of these bus companies, do they have policies or rules within themselves that says you need to check the bus before you leave it for the day, for the night?
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, absolutely. We take this very, very seriously. No school bus company wants to be in the local newspaper having this occur. We have training sessions with our drivers. A lot of our bus companies have voluntarily installed a safe student button in the back of the bus, causes the driver to actually walk to the back of the bus and push that button before they get off. Some have suggested that we mandate that into statute. I know I have a couple members who probably don't think that's a great idea, but that was suggested. We're not really into retrofitting $100,000 buses. But I know one particular bus company, they have a sign that the driver must place in the door that says, empty, I have checked. I mean, it's a very serious thing, and we take it very seriously, and we're doing everything that we can to make it not happen at all. You know, and as I said in the other committees, we transport millions of miles of students over the year, and there are a couple of these a year that happen, and they are newspaper worthy, and there's been some articles in the Star Tribune in regards to this sort of thing. we just think the penalty for 1 year is excessive.
Thank you. Further questions from members? Representative Moline.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Maybe if council could clarify for me, if staff could clarify, for the bottom of page one of the bill, lines 1.22 and 1.23, where it says a violation of subdivision 6 is a gross misdemeanor, is that still part of the bill, or was that removed in the amendment? I just can't figure it out.
Was the question directed?
Staff.
Sorry.
Ms. Perez.
Madam Chair and members, I believe that portion is still in there, and the violation of subdivision 6 that it refers to is on the next page at the top in section 4.
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So that's what I was referencing in my earlier line of questioning, that there still is a gross misdemeanor in the bill for the employee or driver of the bus if they're the person that operates a bus that is supposed to not be operated, supposedly. So it sounds like the gross misdemeanor was taken out for the portion dealing with the inspection, but not for the portion of whether or not an out-of-service vehicle is being used, just for clarity. Thank you.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe the State Patrol or Mr. Keller could answer this, but what does out-of-service mean? If the windshield wiper isn't working and it's a sunny day, is it still out of service?
Lieutenant Rue.
Madam Chair, Representative and other members, we have an inspection criteria, and essentially the critical components such as brakes, tires, the safety features of the bus that are designed, steering, suspension, if any of those items have a defect, that would place that bus or vehicle out of service. So there's other minor violations, like you mentioned, a windshield wiper, clearance light. Those do not place the bus out of service, and that would not be an issue. It's just clearly if there's a safety defect, a critical inspection item, that would put that vehicle out of service.
So
Representative Drazkowski.
So these are, again, we don't have the pictures, so we like pictures, though. this is the yellow school bus. We're still on the yellow school bus here. Okay.
Please, Madam Chair.
Lieutenant Rue.
Madam Chair and Representative, essentially the Type 3s get inspected as well, so the same thing. If they had a brake issue and we put it out of service and they used it. So this is all school buses based on inspection.
Madam Chair, last question. So to the State Patrol, where did the government bring this bill, or who, or did Representative Seltzer bring this bill, or where did it come from?
Mr. Keller.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Drazkowski, in the fall, it was under our understanding this was a housekeeping bill. And I think you can tell that since I've testified in every committee objecting to at least the section I'm talking about today, that I think it's a little beyond what a housekeeping bill is. And I'd also like to just add very quickly that, you know, the driver would end up making two penalties, would get the gross misdemeanor and lose the S endorsement for a year for the same violation.
Representative Paymar, did your committee need to hear this bill?
Well, Madam Chair, there still is the gross misdemeanor in here, and I'm just not sure if Representative Seltzer alerted the committee about the bill or not. Everything's been happening so fast, so she may have. And there is no fiscal note is zero, so it's sort of a toss-up, but I guess not necessarily.
Okay. Further questions? Remember, Representative Drazkowski.
Madam Chair, I don't know if my question is fully answered. So did the government bring this bill?
Sorry, Major Silky.
Madam Chair, Representative, this is a Department of Public Safety initiative. The Department of Public Safety is tasked with being the lead on the pupil transportation and anything related to the school bus transportation. And Lieutenant Brian Rue is the director of the pupil transportation, and one of his duties is to proactively address any concerns. And if I could just respond to maybe, I think, some misinformation and confusion related to the amendment. Currently, it is not a gross misdemeanor for failing to, currently there is no requirement for anyone, any bus driver, to do a post-trip inspection. There's a pre-trip inspection required. However, we're trying to address these children that have been left on the buses in these extreme weather conditions where they've been locked in the bus, crawled out the window, walked out into traffic, tried getting into cars thinking it was their parents' vehicle. So we're trying to address the safety concern of not having a post-trip inspection by requiring that in the bill. I would share that it's not a gross misdemeanor, as Mr. Kelleher alluded to. It's actually a petty misdemeanor. So there wouldn't be the crime associated with that. There is the administrative sanction that we do propose related to the school bus endorsement only being disqualified. It would still allow the driver to drive coach bus, maintain their commercial vehicle driver's license, and perform in other duties related to that. And if I could just maybe address the due process discussion as well. The due process is only is addressed because the administrative sanction only takes place upon conviction of the court, and then that information then being reported to the Department of Public Safety. And in response to the request for the increased fine, and all due respect, and we've made many concessions to the bill, and we have really worked aggressively to try to make it amenable to the parties involved. And in a previous committee, there was a request for a reduction of the fine. We did accommodate that. We did make the petty misdemeanor. And so now, in all due respect for Mr. Kelleher, to ask for the increased fine is somewhat different than maybe what the previous discussions were, and we obliged and conceded to the petty misdemeanor in the past. So I would just share that the currently it is not the gross misdemeanor, it's a petty misdemeanor, and the disqualification is an administrative sanction if, in fact, they're found guilty of not only the not the performing the inspection, but an actual child is left on the bus.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wonder about different parts of this bill. It seems the department is being rather aggressive. I think we're seeing the merging point or the separation point, if depending on how you look at it, between kind of stuff happens and common sense versus are these actual intentional criminal behavior that we're looking at here. These bus drivers that I know anyway, and I'm sure Mr. Kelleher would echo my comments, they care about their kids more than anybody else on their bus, and they go out of their way and do work to do the right thing, and sometimes in life stuff happens. I just wonder if we're writing a law and writing criminal behavior here in regard to Section 4 and then the other language that you said, and it is taken out in the amendment, I understand that, on the other section. If we're writing bills and writing law to try to create penalties or consequences for things that, stuff happens when we got 5.4 million people in Minnesota. So that's all I had, Madam Chair.
Final question, Representative Scott, and then we're going
to
vote.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is to Mr. Kelleher. What happens to a bus driver now if he accidentally leaves a kid on the bus? Are there some consequences within the company?
Mr. Kelleher.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, a lot of the bus companies have an individual corporate policy depending on what the supervisor or owner of the company believes is an appropriate penalty. In some cases, the driver is let go, but not always. It's the difference between, 5 minutes, 2 minutes versus some longer period of time. And I'm obviously trying not to get into that sort of discussion about how long it's appropriate or inappropriate to have a child unattended on a bus. And I should just clarify real quickly, it was my understanding that it was a gross misdemeanor for leaving a child unattended on the bus and the license. If it's a petty misdemeanor and you lose your S endorsement for a year, then I just read this wrong. I apologize.
I guess the point I was just trying to make is that it seems like sometimes this, like Representative Drazkowski said, stuff happens, but companies already kind of self-police this sort of thing. So I don't know that the bill's necessary.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, the chair renews her motion that House File 2481 as amended be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Seltzer. All right. The next item, it's my understanding that there's agreement on Representative Simon's bill, House File 859, and so that it should be quick. Representative Simon, I'll move that House File 859 be re-referred to the General Register, and it's my understanding that you have a DE3
right
to bring folks together. The chair will move the DE3 to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be very
passed here. Back in 2007 or 2008, I had a bill which passed which clarified the conditions under which a victim of domestic violence could get out of a residential lease. A few years on, there's some issues that have to be resolved, although it's been successful enabling people to do that. There's some issues that have to be expanded upon and resolved. The stakeholders, who are basically represented by the two people to my left, have been working for many months since last fall to resolve any differences, and they vow that there will be no bill at all until and unless they agree. I'll have them speak to the bill, but let me just say, I think they're going to enunciate for you. There are only now, of many, many issues, two very small issues on which there is not complete agreement, and they'll enunciate that, but they shouldn't hold the bill, and both of them think that we should pass the bill.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, and go ahead, and let's make it real clear that, members, we said we would hear the bill because we thought they were very, very close to agreement, and let's hear about the agreement.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and that is absolutely true. The delete all, even though it's a delete all, it really doesn't change much from the bill that was seen in civil law. It's only more of a format and some technical changes, and that's why it was a delete all, just from a format standpoint. We have been working, as Representative Simon said, with the Multi-Housing Association for a while. I really want to thank Todd Liljenquist and his members and the Multi-Housing Association. They've been really fantastic in trying to make this work. The bottom line here is that we have this bill, this law in place to help victims of violence to leave the premises if necessary and try to balance the protections for them with the ability of the landlords to get adequate compensation for the expected those expected damages that they're losing. So I'm happy to discuss the specifics of the bill, but in the interest of time, I can just say that I'll pass it over to Mr. Liljenquist to just discuss the two little final items that we'll work on, if that's okay with you.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Todd Liljenquist, I represent the Multi-Housing Association, and I, too, want to thank the author and Legal Aid. We've been working in good faith for, I think, close to 6 months on this bill, and I think we are extremely close, and I would encourage you to move the bill forward. There are two remaining items, and one is as to the name of the perpetrator and whether or not the disclosure required in law currently balances the interest there, and then also the standard to which the qualified third-party statement will be held. And I'm confident that we can come to some sort of agreement, and if we do not, then and it seems appropriate at that time, then we will try and come back next year. But I think we can reach that agreement as it gets to the floor.
Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, the chair will renew the motion that House File 859, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye. 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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Representative Johnson, it's my understanding that your bill is like 5 minutes.
Yes.
So Representative Johnson moves that House File 2386 be re-referred to the General Register, and it's my understanding, Representative Johnson, that you have an author's amendment, which is the A14 amendment. Is that correct?
That's correct. I'd like to move that amendment.
Representative Johnson moves the A14 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Johnson.
This is, in effect, the Board of Public Defense unsessioned bill. It's been signed off by the county attorney and the courts. I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Cahir just to briefly walk through the main points.
Madam Chair and members.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
My name is Kevin Cahir with the Board of Public Defense. Madam Chair and members, Section 1 eliminates the requirement that we provide three additional copies to the court on post-conviction relief measures. Frankly, the court doesn't want them. And there really is no need. That will be obsolete when we fully go to e-filing and e-service. The second section eliminates the requirement of a public defender reimbursement report. All of that information is available in the biennial budget. We, of course, keep it. We need to have it. The original intent of that was when these funds originally went to the general fund, there was legislation that moved that money into overhead for our part-time public defenders. And so the legislature wanted to see what kind of changes, if any, there would be in those reimbursements. That was back in 1999, I believe. The Section 3 eliminates a provision that the offender's attorney is the deemed notice in a restitution hearing or restitution situation. And right now, the restitution notice should go to the offender, who would then contact the attorney whether or not they would want to challenge that restitution. So a lot of this grows out of the fact that those restitution orders aren't put in place until after sentencing. So a lot of times the case is closed and our folks are already discharged from the case. With that, we can obviously stand for any questions. Kathy Middlebrook, who's our chief appellate defender, is here to answer questions on sections 1 and 2, 3, if there are any.
Questions from members? Seeing none, first, Representative Druskowski, before we go to your amendment, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right, seeing none, Representative Druskowski, it's my understanding that you have the A1 amendment.
I do, Madam Chair. If I could ask, before I move it, if I could ask Mr. Kyer a question about it.
Go ahead, Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Kyer, you mentioned that this information is in the biennial budget. I'm assuming you're meaning the lump sum amount of reimbursements, not exactly which courts have been receiving those reimbursements and which have not, and the amounts for each respectively.
Madam Chair, Representative Druskowski, that's correct. So the total amount is in the biennial budget. We obviously have to keep it by judicial district because that's how it has to be distributed to the part-time defenders. So the information is available.
Representative Druskowski.
Madam Chair, I move the A1 amendment.
Representative Druskowski, why don't you tell us what the A1 amendment does?
The A1 amendment, Madam Chair, restores the stricken language on lines 2.3 through 2.9, which would allow us to continue to receive this information. Madam Chair, members, we did use this information, if you recall, last year during the budgeting period. Although we did not do a lot about it, we started to dig into these details around which counties were, or which courts were receiving the reimbursements and which were not. And it's an area that we can certainly do some work around. We just haven't completely got there yet. And, I think it would be, we would be remiss to give up this information.
Representative Johnson.
I'll take that as a friendly amendment, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Johnson says that the A1 amendment is a friendly amendment, so all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevail. Representative Johnson renews his motion that House File 2386, is that it? Yep, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Lesch. Yeah. Representative Lesch. It's my understanding that you have House File 2958, which is short. Is that correct, Representative Lesch?
I wouldn't use the phrase short, Madam Chair.
That it will take a short, brief period of time?
Call it brief, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Lesch. Yep. Moves that House File 2958 be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Lesch.
Madam Chair, House File 2958 allows a person who's brought a civil court action in district court for a violation of Minnesota Human Rights Act to have a jury trial. We have worked with the Minnesota Retailers Association and the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce to insert language whereby the respondent would also be entitled to a jury trial. But to explain why, I have my testifier.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Frances Ballion. I'm an attorney practicing in Minneapolis at the law firm of Ballion, Dome, Joswick, and Wanta. I represent employees exclusively in the area of employment law, dealing with disputes involving discrimination, harassment, retaliation, breach of contract and other like claims. I've been doing this for 15 years. The bill before this committee, Bill 2958, is an important one. It is a bill that will preserve the Minnesota State Constitution's guarantee to a right to a jury trial for civil rights claims under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. The guarantee to a jury trial has been enshrined in our state's constitution since its inception, since 1857. It is a right that our constitution holds to be inviolate, meaning something that is untouchable. The beginning part of any analysis in deciding whether or not a cause or claim has a right to a jury trial is whether it is one at law, meaning does it seek money damages. Our state Supreme Court has recently addressed this issue in the context of employment claims. For example, in the Abraham case, the Minnesota Supreme Court held that retaliatory discharge claims under our state's Whistleblower Act are causes of action at law and deserve a guaranteed jury trial. The same as the court held similarly with respect to claims for attorney's fees under a breach of contract claim. And ironically, our federal courts have held that there is a right to a jury trial for claims under the Minnesota Human Rights Act. And this anomaly exposes an irony. If I go and take a claim for discrimination or any other sort of claim under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, and I go file in federal court, my client will have a right to a jury trial. If I go two blocks down to Hennepin County and file the same complaint, my client does not have that same constitutionally guaranteed right. That's a distinction that should not exist. Our Constitution guarantees actions at law, those kinds of claims that are under the Human Rights Act, a guarantee to a jury trial. And I'm going to borrow a phrase from a colleague of mine who I think has talked about this issue, who is far more eloquent than I am. And he talked about the fundamental measure of good justice is how a person feels when they lose. And that's really a true statement. And I would say for plaintiff or defendant alike, when a person or a party loses in front of a judge, there's always a feeling left over of maybe being outmaneuvered or that someone knew the judge or there's something going on behind the scenes that a party doesn't have a role in. But a loss with a jury, a group of either party's peers, is different. A jury is the great equalizer in a courtroom. They level the playing field for both parties, plaintiff and defendant alike. And I don't think I've ever had a client say they didn't get a fair shot and that they weren't heard by their peers. And I think it's those principles and those ideas that supported our framers' belief and idea that the jury trial is the essence of fair justice. If anybody has any questions, I will remain here to answer them.
Questions from members? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one piece of clarification on the bill. On 1.12, it says the respondent is entitled to a jury trial. I'm assuming, Representative Lesch, that means they have the option to request one rather than it's automatic, and that what prompts me to say that is on 1.13 and 1.14, it shows order or verdict or court or jury. So could you just clarify that for sure?
Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Drazkowski, that's correct. The requester may also waive it.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Lesch. One last question. Fiscal note on this one, Representative Lesch.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, the fiscal note came back as zero.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lesch, I'm wondering what, if any, burden you anticipate this placing on the court based on any possible pending situations?
Madam Chair and Representative Pugh, the fiscal note came back as zero, said that they anticipated one additional jury trial per year based on my recollection.
Representative Pugh? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Hi, my name is Ben Gerber. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce on labor issues. I do want to thank Representative Lesch. It's always appreciated when, even though you're opposed to the actual motive behind the bill or the idea behind the bill, that they're willing to make changes to address some of your concerns. So I want to start out by thanking Representative Lesch a lot for that. And Representative Lesch was willing to accept the change that was made in the Senate, which allows either party, the plaintiff or the defendant, to if they so choose, to represent a jury trial. I want to briefly address a few of the issues. I think the previous testifier brought up that that there is a right to a jury trial in these federal discrimination claims. And I think that the federal courts are a little different than the state courts, especially state court judges after they're appointed are up for election. They're more susceptible to outside influence, and I'm not to say that actually happens. We have a lot of good judges in the state, but it's something that the business community is concerned about. One of the major things about of why we haven't had a right to a jury trial, and while the Minnesota Constitution does grant that right, there's other areas of law in Minnesota where we restrict that right to a jury trial, and included among those are no-fault auto insurance. So it hasn't been recognized as an absolute right across the board. The reason why the jury issue is important is that these are very intense and emotional cases, especially in cases of alleged discrimination, and it makes it a lot more difficult for a jury to work through those issues. And right now it's important to note that Minnesota judges can appoint an advisory jury if they so choose, and that's done in Minnesota human rights cases. This bill would likely require a jury trial for most cases, and we believe it's better for judges to have discretion. It would increase the burden and workload for judges. Right now, with a judge hearing these cases, they can schedule their calendar around motions. It's a lot harder with a jury when you have people that are there for the day to move in and out of your calendar. We believe that it would increase the burden on court administrators. But I think what's also important to note is we heard that it might result in one extra jury case. And that's because these cases are extremely expensive for businesses to defend themselves in. When we spoke to some defense attorneys, even to try to get to a summary judgment motion, and which is often not successful because these are issues of fact, we're talking about, in some cases, $50,000, a lot of cases, at least $10,000 at a minimum, which for a small business means bankruptcy. And so that's why we're really worried that this is kind of putting the thumb on the scale of justice, and it can be used as leverage for settlement, which might not clog up the courts, but it unnecessarily burdens businesses with a claim that might not be legitimate. But you have the choice of spending $50,000 to defend yourself or settling. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of businesses will be forced into the settlement if they can afford it. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll stand for questions.
Questions from members. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the most recent testifier. Wondering what examples might there be in any other states of statute like this, and what impact has it had on the burden placed on the court system?
Ben, or Mr. Gerber.
Madam Chair, Representative Pugh, I'm not as familiar with the right in other states. I've looked. There's a great expansion this year in Minnesota law. There has been. Nothing has passed yet on increasing the amount of causes of action under the Human Rights Act. So this is adding not only this jury trial right, but we're putting a lot of new causes of action in place. And so that's actually what we're worried about too. But to directly answer your question, I don't know about surrounding states or other states.
All right. Anyone else in the audience wanted to testify for or against this bill? All right. Seeing none, Representative Lesh renews his motion. Where is it? That House File 2958 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. All right. Representative Lesh, it's my understanding your next bill will be somewhat brief as well. 2925.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Lesh. You're moving that it go to the Civil Law Committee, and it's my understanding that you have a DE3 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. Representative Lesh moves the DE3 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Lesh.
So, Madam Chair, what bill is this again? I didn't hear the number that you said.
This is your 2925 Exonerated Persons Compensation
yes.
Bill, Representative
Okay,
Lesh.
Thank you.
It's the last bill you have on the calendar, Representative Lesh, and then there's one more after you.
Thank you.
Representative Lesh, it's my understanding it was a DE1 amendment, not a DE3
Madam
amendment.
Chair, I have two oral amendments that go to the DE1 amendment.
So the chair needs to we need to reconsider the DE3 amendment because you are offering the DE1 amendment.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
So we will reconsider the DE3 amendment and go with the DE1 amendment. So all those in favor of reconsideration of a DE3 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Lesh moves the DE1 amendment. Do you want to make that oral change before we adopt the DE1 amendment, Representative Lesh?
I do, Madam Chair.
Where are they?
On line 6.4, delete Attorney General and insert Office of Minnesota Management and Budget.
6.4.
Who are we inserting? Representative
Lesh? We are inserting the words Office of Minnesota Management and Budget. And this is to address Attorney General concerns.
Okay. And any other oral amendments, Representative Lesh?
Yes, Madam Chair. In Section 8, lines 5.18 to 5.30, delete that section and those lines.
So from 5.18 to 2.0?
To 5.30.
To 5.30, okay.
And is that all within Section 8, Madam Chair, or is there a separate Section 8 that I don't have the amendment
printed? That is Section 8.
Okay, great. Then that's what I want deleted, Madam Chair. And this is because of an ongoing discussion with the Department of Corrections. We're trying to help them out.
So, Representative Lesh, is there anything left then in the bill that actually is the district court ordering and not through this panel?
I'm sorry, repeat that, Madam Chair.
So, Representative Lesh, it's my understanding that there's this compensation panel, and you just deleted the section that talks about the district court. Is there anything left in the bill, then, that is district court-related and not just the panel?
That's a good question, Madam Chair.
I know there's a judicial review on Section 5.13 to 5.17, but is there anything else? I just want to make sure that we talk about the things that are within the jurisdiction of this committee, and I want to know if there's anything else.
One moment, Madam Chair.
Oh, so it is the Supreme Court who is setting up the compensation panel. So, Representative Lesh, does this have a fiscal note for the court, that the Supreme Court is to set up the compensation panel? Representative Lesh, because I have a zero budget target. If it costs any money, we don't have the money.
Okay, there's no note, but it's been requested, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry?
There's no note, but it's been requested. And we will, if it comes back with anything, we'll deal with that, Madam Chair. And in fact, I believe it's our intent. Say again, Madam Chair?
I have a zero budget target, Representative Lesh, so if it comes back with any money, it's going to have to come back.
Understood, Madam Chair.
All right, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lesh, you need to move the DE1 as amended to get the bill in the shape the author would like it.
I do so move, Madam Chair.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for hearing this bill. Madam Chair, like you, I and members of the committee are proud of Minnesota's criminal justice system, and all Minnesotans are proud of that. It delivers fantastic justice, in my opinion, better than many other states. But it's not perfect, and two gentlemen sitting to my left are evidence to the fact that it is not perfect. Shortly, you'll hear from them. These two men served years in prison for crimes they did not commit, and when they were proven innocent, they were released from prison with no assistance from the state and no official apology for what had happened to them. They did not get any money, any housing, any transportation, health services, or insurance. And they have a criminal record that is not cleared despite their innocence. They have psychological consequences that stem from being deprived from their family and their friends and the ability to build a career during the time where they were locked up. Minnesota does not help those who were convicted in this manner and served time and later found innocent. It does not help them get reintegrated into society. In fact, when guilty people are released from prison, parole officers help them find housing and jobs, and there's mental health and chemical counseling available for these folks. We do more to help them become productive members of society than we do for those who, in the very few instances, are found not to be guilty of the crimes that they did not commit.
The federal criminal system has a compensation statute for instances like this, and 29 states and the District of Columbia do as well. This puts Minnesota in the minority of states that do not address the injustice that those who were wrongly imprisoned suffer. This bill is not at all meant to point fingers or to second-guess the fine work of Minnesota's prosecutors and their courts. Sometimes mistakes happen, but it does create an additional safeguard into our state's legal system. So with that, I would like to introduce John Hopeman.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of this honorable committee. My name is John Hopeman. I'm a lawyer. I have offices in Minneapolis and St. Paul. I was a federal prosecutor for 11 years. It's my honor to speak for this bill. There's only one thing worse than being accused of a crime, and that is to be accused of a crime which you did not commit. The bill does not cast blame. It simply recognizes that we as imperfect human beings cannot perfectly administer justice. As one who worked in the system for nearly 40 years, I can tell you that we have excellent law enforcement officers in Minnesota, and judges and prosecutors and defense lawyers, probation officers, investigators. But it still happens. It happens rarely, but it still happens. These wrongful convictions can happen even though it's no one's fault. I once prosecuted a man who was totally innocent. He was informed on by an informant who was a liar. The FBI called the man in, accused him of 3 bank robberies, and he began to confess. And having confessed, he then was assigned a public defender, and he pled guilty to 3 bank robberies. And I thought I had the right guy. And as he was in custody awaiting his sentence for 3 or 4 months, the probation officer was doing a pre-sentence report. And a very careful probation officer discovered that the man was in custody for very minor offenses at the same time all 3 robberies occurred. And what it was mental illness drove him to confess, but it wasn't obvious. That's the point I want to get across. You can't always see it coming because it's not obvious. And I like to think I was a careful prosecutor. I know he had a good defense lawyer. We had a good judge. But it still happened. He was innocent as a lamb, but it still happened. We paid him a little money. He was a little disappointed not to go to prison. He was so crazy. But under the federal system, there's a compensation system for men like this. And we don't have it in this state. Today you're going to hear from 2 innocent men, Kuo Fong Lee to the far left and Michael Hansen, and both were convicted and imprisoned here in Minnesota for crimes that they did not commit. In Mr. Lee's case, his Toyota ran away from him and 3 people were killed and he was prosecuted and convicted after trial. Now we know that Toyotas, thousands of them, were defective and ran away regularly. We didn't know that then, and that's why he was convicted. Mr. Hansen was convicted of murdering his infant daughter and served almost 7 years. And in that case, the expert witness medical testimony was totally defective. And later it was revealed with the help of 5 or 6 other experts that it was defective, and he was also released. But when they're released, they had no jobs, no means, no housing, no insurance, no health care. And they'll tell you that the stigma of having been convicted persists. So this statute would help men like these 2 men and their families get their lives back. I think it's the right thing to do. Thank you for hearing me out.
Thank you, Mr. Holtman. And if the other testifiers want to state their names for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Michael Hansen. In 2004, my 3-month-old daughter died suddenly while under my care. I was convicted and spent nearly 7 years in prison before my sentence was reversed. If it weren't for the hard work of a group of attorneys, the Innocence Project, who were certain of my innocence, I would still be sitting in prison until 2015, July 17th of 2015. I won't ever get those 7 years back. We only have one life to live, and those 7 years got taken from me. I'm sorry if I'm a little emotional, but this has affected me and my family a great deal. My parents spent $100,000 on three lawyers, not counting bonding out $250,000 one time, $160,000 another time. My dad's 7 years old, my mom's 65 years old. They've worked hard their whole life, and I've had to watch their life deteriorate and still paying on their mortgage that would have been paid 10 years ago. I'm still working to get my life back. Prison broke me, made me accept something that I should have never have had to accept. I always thought, I believed in the state my whole life. I believed in law enforcement as a kid, running out to the police cars, asking for football cards. I believe in the system. I believe we have a good system. I don't think it's perfect. I don't think it could ever be perfect. And this isn't something that's supposed to make me and my family rich. It's supposed to help me get my life back. I had a life. I had children in my house. I lived with my children. I'm no longer with my children's mother anymore. This has stolen everything from me. I had a life. I was building a family. I had a full-time job, benefits. It was a place I never thought I was going to leave. When I was released from prison, they didn't need the extra work, and they wanted me to come back there, but they simply just didn't have the work for me, and I had to go look for other work, and and I don't have benefits now, and I'm starting my life over. Those 7 years of my life were a very important part of my life, and I think we all can agree there's a turning point in your life when you grow up, and there's some extra response. You really become an adult, and those were a good part of my life. And psychologically, what prison did to me, mentally and physically, I'll never get that back, ever. I only have one life to live. Like I said, I've always believed in the state of Minnesota and the judicial system, but my faith in the system faded with each day I spent in prison for a crime I did not commit. A couple weeks ago, we had our first hearing before the Senate Finance Committee. After that hearing, every legislator on that committee approached me, shook my hand, looked at me in the eye, and apologized on behalf of the state of Minnesota. That was the first time ever that I've ever had anybody with the authority and responsibility, the moral. We look up to you guys. We look up to the system. And my family has always, even if it's just giving money to the policeman's ball or the fireman's ball. That got stolen away from me. I don't think our system is perfect, but I think that this will help make it better. It does happen. I'm sitting here before you as an innocent man who went to prison for 7 years for something he did not do. And I sat in prison, looked at as a guilty person. That time with my family, my friends, just even growing. My life halted as soon as I entered those doors. Our last hearing was a positive step towards what we're trying to accomplish here. And like we said, we're not trying to make anybody rich. We're just trying to give these people their life back. And it's not many. It's very far and few in between. But it's not perfect. The system isn't perfect, and it happens. And as the authority of Minnesota needs to stand on their own 2 feet, just like everybody they asked to stand in front of that judge and stand on their own 2 feet and take responsibility for the things they've done. I was asked to take a plea bargain in my daughter's death. What this does to a person, I'll never get that. I'll never get my life back ever. And I'm just asking for the state to step up and do what true Minnesotans do, besides griping about the winter. Minnesota's awesome. I love it here. I don't know why that had nothing to do with anything, but I'm nervous. Sorry. The next positive step will be to pass this proposal and legislation. Thank you all for your time. If you have any questions, I'll be more than happy to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen, for your testimony. Mr. Lee, if you want to state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Kuo Fong Lee, and I was wrongfully convicted of vehicle homicide in 2007 after my Toyota Camry accelerated uncontrollably at the end of the freeway exit ramp in St. Paul. Our car crashed into three vehicles, ultimately killing a man and two children. After spending 2 years, 9 months, and 24 days in prison, Toyota revealed that some of its cars were experiencing acceleration issues. The Innocent Project of Minnesota helped my team of lawyers prove that my car malfunctioned, causing it to accelerate and crash. I spent nearly 3 years in prison before I was exonerated and released. During this time, I missed the birth of my youngest child. It broke my heart to miss this important moment in my family's life. My wife and I have 4 young children. And when I was released from prison, and my children did not know who I was, and the two oldest had lost touch with me, and the two youngest did not know me at all. It took a long time for me to earn their trust and build my credibility as a father. And now, I'm proud to say that this spring, I will graduate from Inver Hill Community College with an Associate in Art degree. My time in prison set me back many years career-wise, but I am working as hard as I can to get my life back to where it was, so that I can be the provider I want to be for my family. And nothing can buy the time that I spend away from my family, but this compensation statute will help a little bit. And finally, I urge you to pass this legislation because it is the right thing to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lee, for sharing your story. Are there questions from members? Seeing none. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to be heard? Mr. Kingery, if you could state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, my name is John Kingery, speaking on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. We certainly want justice to be done. I don't think anybody questions that at all. Individuals, and as Representative Lesh said, we've got a darn good system here in Minnesota. Is it perfect? No, it isn't. But individuals are convicted on the best evidence available. When that goes awry, they should be recognized. They should be made whole in some manner. An easy example would be if new physical or scientific evidence is brought forward establishing innocence. I don't think we would question that at all. Those individuals should be certainly made whole. We have spoken to both the House and Senate authors of this bill. We have expressed a number of concerns. What I will pledge to the committee and to the authors is that we will work with them. We want to tighten up some of the language in terms of based on innocence. We want to look at maybe some definitional things there. And also, when a new trial is ordered and the state dismisses the charges, the charges may be dismissed because a witness is no longer available or refuses to come forward. So there are reasons in some cases why the case is dismissed when it is sent back. And with that, Madam Chairman, I'm just going to indicate that the bill, as it's been introduced, we do have some concerns, and it's been out there for a little over 2 weeks, and it's going to take us a little bit longer to work with the authors to try to see if we can't resolve some of those concerns.
Are there questions from members? Seeing none, I just want to thank the testifiers for coming in. That was really, I think, difficult testimony for even us to hear. And although the bill in front of us would provide some monetary compensation, we, of course, can never compensate you for the time that you lost with your family. So sorry about that. Representative Lesh, with that, renews his motion to move House File 2925 as amended to be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, motion is adopted.
Members, the final bill on the agenda is House File 807. Members, Representative Mullery submitted a number of amendments without the 24-hour deadline, of course, being met. So we're going to have him walk through the amendments quick. Then we're going to consult with the Republicans to make sure we know if they have objections to any of them, and then we'll vote on the bill. So Representative Mullery, welcome to the committee. The chair will move that House File 807 be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Mullery, it's my understanding that the DE2 amendment, is that the main amendment that
I'm
you
sorry,
want?
Which one?
Representative Mullery, so are we working off the bill as it is introduced, or is the DE2 amendment kind
no,
of the...
it's the bill as introduced.
Okay. So Representative Mullery, go ahead and talk to us about first the bill, and then tell us about the amendments. And then we'll make sure everyone understands them before we vote on anything.
Madam
Representative
Chair,
Mullery.
We go through the amendments to put it in the shape the author wants, and then I can talk about it. For one thing, most of the bill is something that an amendment would take out.
Just a moment. Representative Drazkowski, did you hear Representative Mullery's request? Representative Mullery, why don't you make that request again? It's just
okay.
I don't think all of these amendments are amendments that everybody likes. And so... Representative Mullery, we just want to make sure everybody has the opportunity to hear them because, again, they came in, some of them, just very, very a short time ago. So, Representative Mullery.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'll explain what the A3 amendment would do. It would be take out all of Sections 1, 2, and 3 and then change the effective date of the bill in line 6.17 from 2013 to 2014. So it would take all of the sections that refer to sex offender registration. Everything related to that would be taken out of this bill totally.
Okay. Representative Drazkowski, would it be okay if we did that one? This is the one that actually cleans up the bill and takes out all the sex offender registry, so we don't have to talk about those provisions.
A3.
Okay. So I will move, it's the A, did you say the A2 amendment or the A3 amendment?
The A3
amendment. The chair would move the A3 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, the A6 amendment cleans up some language that I believe was brought by the County Attorneys Association, but I'm not sure. I know that they want to clean this language up because it turns out that offender doesn't include petty misdemeanor, juvenile petty, or juvenile traffic offense, and obviously those should also be included in the word in the definition of offender. When a child is under the jurisdiction of juvenile court as an offender, if it's a petty misdemeanor, they're there. They should also be considered an offender within the rest of the statute.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious, if we just deleted Sections 1 and 2, this is amending Section 2.
Representative Mullery.
Oh, Madam Chair, Ms. Pirius will have to explain how.
Ms. Pirius.
Mr. Chair, members, it's not actually amending Section 2.
Oh.
It's placing that now new section on page 6, line 18, which is at the very end of the bill, and now we're down to only two sections
I
in the
see.
Bill, so that's the numbering,
right,
taking into account that first
thank
amendment.
You. I should have noticed
okay.
that.
Okay, thank you.
Don't doubt Ms. Furious.
I see that you have someone here from the county attorneys. Is that where the language came from, or if you could please
you
clarify?
Madam Chair, Janet Ryder. I'm the Chisago County Attorney. I'm also chair of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association Juvenile Law Committee. And so, yes, the language referenced in the A6 amendment, including the petty misdemeanor, juvenile, petty, and juvenile traffic offenses, is the language proposed by the County Attorneys Association to include a broader array or range of offenses which would be eligible for diversion.
All right, if you could talk about the other amendments.
Madam Chair, instead of doing the, I don't think I was clear to Ms. Perius on the A4, so in, basically what, instead of the A4, I would request the amendment on line 6.6, just strike the word 3 and insert the word 2 instead.
On?
Line 6.6 of the bill. Strike the word 3 and insert the word 2.
And what's the effect of doing that, Representative Mallory?
I had talked to a lot of people that do treatment, and they thought it should be 3 additional ones, but some people want shorter periods, so I agreed to come down to 2 additional that will cover most treatment programs. So the court would still be allowed to order a normal treatment program if we come down to 2.
And your other amendment, Representative Mallory.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure who this came from, but I know that the county attorneys say it's a good amendment. Probation says that it's they don't care one way or the other. But they don't have any problem with it. It seems to make sense. What it does is it allows...
Which amendment is it, Representative Mallory?
Amendment? I'm sorry, Madam Chair, A5. And Madam Chair, the A5 amendment, what it does is it allows what's already done in a number of jurisdictions. The police officers can have their own diversion program as long as... And what this would do, what it would limit that to a nonviolent offense... and wouldn't apply to any situation where a order or a warrant had been issued by a court to take a child into custody. So under other offenses that are nonviolent, no warrant or order to take the child into custody, the police could continue to have diversion programs of their own. Right now, you know, as the chair knows, the county attorneys have diversion programs. Sometimes the counties do. And sometimes the police do. But now, you know, as the chair knows, the county attorneys have diversion programs. Sometimes the counties do. And sometimes the police do. But apparently some police are unsure whether it's already allowed in the law. So this would clarify that what many jurisdictions are doing would be legal for everybody to do.
And this is strictly for juvenile offenders?
This is only, Madam Chair, some people wanted to add some adult provisions to this, and I said, no, this is a juvenile bill.
Okay, any other amendments, Representative Mallory?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. So are there any questions from members? We're going to call for some testimony. Members, we're going to... We're going to recess for just a few minutes. I'm going to consult with Representative Druskowski because these amendments didn't meet deadline. We just want to make sure that everyone understands what they are and we find out if there's objections. But is there anyone in the audience that was planning to speak to any of these issues? We want to make sure the committee has full understanding of what's going on here. Go ahead. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, Janet Ryder. I'm the Chisago County Attorney. I'm also Chair of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association Juvenile Law Committee. I will speak first to the language which was referred to as Amendment A6. And again, just to reiterate, we are comfortable with that language. We're glad that that amendment is moving forward to this bill. Again, it is to give clear guidance to each of the counties with regard to what offenses can be diverted under their authority to conduct diversion programs. Clearly, petty misdemeanors is a identified category. Juvenile petty offenses and juvenile traffic offenses are a separate category that's defined by statute, and this will just give us clear authority to include as many juveniles into appropriate programming as possible. I would then note Representative Mullery spoke to the amendment with regard to it's on 6-6 of the bill itself, the continuances for basically continuances without adjudication. I would note that, generally speaking, county attorneys have been historically opposed to extending these amounts of time for the stay of adjudication for extraordinary amounts of time. Currently, our laws allow for 2 90-day periods, essentially 6 months of a stay for a juvenile to be continued without being adjudicated. We had come to a mid-ground and had been somewhat agreeable to up to 280-day periods, which would allow a juvenile to be continued without an adjudication if they were complying with programming and complying with their terms of probation for up to 1 year. We think that that's important. It does allow for juveniles to access the treatment programs that they need. We are a little bit concerned and happy that the amendment today would bring it back down to one initial 180-day period with up to two additional. That gives us a year and a half for a juvenile to complete sometimes very complicated treatment. But we keep in mind that this is a tool that will be used and applied not just to the most extreme or extraordinary juvenile offenders, but it will be applied to even more minor cases. We are finding that as an appropriate middle ground. Finally, the amendment A5, there are some issues with the language in that amendment that I think that should be clarified prior to moving forward, and perhaps they can be clarified later. But in juvenile law and the actions of law enforcement, juveniles technically are deemed to be taken into custody and are not technically arrested. So I would propose some changes to that language. And finally, on line 1.13 of the amendment A5, there were some identifying that this would be available to petty offenders and delinquents who may be averted. I would suggest adding alleged or suspected petty offenders or delinquents. At the point that they're being taken into custody and allowed opportunity to take part in a diversion program, oftentimes a prerequisite to actively being involved in a diversion program is that they take responsibility for their conduct. I'm a little concerned about where in the process the issue is that law enforcement have not screened these juveniles past a prosecutor to determine if there's probable cause to move forward or what types of charges might be feasible. In a typical diversion program, we screen the process. We first make a determination whether or not the facts of this case would allow us to hold this juvenile accountable for the offense. And then once we make that initial determination, we would divert to the diversion program. They would then take responsibility for their conduct. And if they fail to comply with the programming, then they can be brought back to court and held accountable yet in a traditional manner. We're just a little concerned about the process and the wording of this language and would want to work with the author to clarify that a little bit more. But otherwise, in concept, we're generally in agreement.
Then, Madam...
Representative Mullery.
Madam Chair, I have no objection and would request if... the committee use her language if that makes she's the expert, not us. I believe it's after the word both on 1.13, add alleged and suspected. Would that be?
Yeah. Representative Mullery, is that an amendment or on the bill?
No, that would be on the amendment A5. On line 1.13, she's suggesting that after the word both, it should say alleged and suspected. I believe she's saying not. There hasn't been a decision made.
I think we could incorporate that into the amendment.
Okay. Thank you,
so that then when we're ready to adopt amendments, we can just incorporate that into that one.
Thank you.
Unless there's an objection
well,
to that.
Representative Hillstrom, I think another suggestion to that A5 amendment was to remove the word arrest or change the word arrest because juvenile offenses aren't considered arrests.
That's correct. Pursuant to statutes, juveniles are taken into custody, and it specifically states that they are taken into custody consistent with the rules relating to arrest. It is a term of art, but I think that it should be clear that we are consistent in this language, consistent with the juvenile code.
So, Ms. Ryder, what language would you suggest to use?
In 1.5, I would suggest that it read, a peace officer may refer a child that the officer has the lawful authority to take into custody or has taken into custody. And then we're on line 1.6, to a diversion program that the law enforcement agency.
Okay, hopefully staff is, yeah, if we could have staff read back what the proposed oral amendment would be.
Madam Chair and members, it's to the A5 amendment on line 1.5, delete arrest and insert take into custody. On line 1.6, delete arrested and insert taken into custody. And on line 1.13, after both, insert alleged and suspected. Is that right?
We would be comfortable with that. Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pirius. And I don't know if we need to vote on adopting that oral amendment, or we can just incorporate it into the A5. All those in favor of adopting the oral amendment to the A5 signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, motion prevails. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, I'm just reading through the A5 amendment here, and I personally have some serious issues with this amendment. Police officers are not, their job description does not entail supervising somebody on a diversion program. That's more up to the courts and the probation, as they have a better chance of monitoring them. Also, an officer does not actually charge the person. He writes a citation or does a report. The charges are done by the attorney's office. This amendment does not even fall into the current responsibilities or how law enforcement operates. It would be real difficult for an officer if he has a shift of six on, like I worked at, one of my shifts was 8 days on, 6 days off. So for 8 days, I could actually supervise the kid, make sure he's doing, but by 6 days off, he could do whatever he wants, and I would have no contact with the individual. We have a lot of departments working like that. Probations are the ones designed to monitor and what's going on, not law enforcement. So it's much better off having the courts getting them into the court system. The courts putting them into a diversion program to let them out. That's just my opinion. I see major problems with this amendment.
Representative Mullery, do you want to?
Madam Chair, I think she could explain it. But first of all, the courts don't do most diversion programs. For instance, Hennepin County attorneys do the diversion program, so getting in the courts doesn't make sense. She's got a technical word, but she says the word is not charged. We'll let her explain it.
Ms. Ryder.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. The process that is used by most county attorneys' offices around the state is that the diversion programs that are mandated by statute are a pre-court and diversion program. So the matters are screened and handled before they get to the court system on any level. And so it is that process that to which you're referring, and I would acknowledge that law enforcement, we would anticipate, would not be monitoring the program or directly monitoring the youth, but that they would be establishing a program maybe through personnel within the police department or another independent agency that would do that on behalf of the police department. I can speak that in Chisago County, the county attorney's diversion program allows for officers to recommend and utilize the diversion program that the county attorneys have in place. And I recognize that in some jurisdictions, law enforcement have an informal type of diversion program. I can't speak to the details of those, and I understand that the goal of this language is to give them that authority. But in each, both law enforcement diversion or county attorney diversion, the goal would be to do that prior to any matter being filed with the court. And that is the concern, for the most part, is that once juveniles' case files or records are presented to the court, it becomes part of another larger database. And so these are a means or mechanism to keep juveniles out of that system. And one technicality that Representative Mullery identified is also, I hate to make things more complicated, in line 1.13, the word charge should be referred to cite. As law enforcement oftentimes will issue a citation and cite a juvenile, they don't technically have that authority to charge or issue charges. That's a prosecutor's function.
Ms. Ryder, are you on the amendment?
I am on the amendment.
What line?
A5, line 1.13. Several words in, that word charge would be deleted and replaced with the word cite. The citation shall be dismissed.
Want to follow on it?
I'm sorry, it should be citation.
So the proposed oral amendment is on line 1.13 of the A5 to delete the word charge and insert the word
citation.
All those in favor of the oral amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed, motion prevails. Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, County Attorney, but maybe I would suggest one other oral amendment on line 1.5, remove authority and put in recommend, because I don't believe the law enforcement should have the authority to do the diversion. It should be up to the to the county attorney's office if it's being possible charges through them. They have access more to their background records than law enforcement do. They have access to more possible court documents that might be out there.
Are there questions from members? Ms. Purius has a suggestion for language she's going to talk to Representative Mullery about. Are there other questions from members on the amendments? I have a question on the A6 amendment. Ms. Ryder, if you could just...
I was going to say, we might want to finish on one amendment and then move to the next one.
Okay.
It's kind of confusing enough. Members, I just want to make it really clear. We have a couple of options. One, we can finish up this bill and finish tonight, or we can come back tomorrow and finish this up. I just want to make it clear to members that we're happy to work on this as long as we need to make sure that we get it right. So we're certainly happy to do it either way. We can schedule another meeting for tomorrow. Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe a question for Ms. Ryder is, I don't know if someone had asked this question, but is there the ability for the county attorney to decide on the diversion rather than the peace officer? And what implication would that have?
I think it, in order to add structure and uniformity to a jurisdiction, I think that it would be helpful if law enforcement were to utilize and or refer the juveniles that they think should be referred to a diversion program to the county attorney's diversion program. Again, it allows for uniformity. It allows a system where we determine whether a juvenile has prior offenses. We determine whether or not the facts of the case warrant holding the juvenile accountable for the alleged offense. So We believe that that would be helpful, and would be, and we would recommend it. Another nuance is that under the county attorney responsibility for running diversion programs, is there is a reporting component that for which we report to the Department of Public Safety with regard to the number of juveniles referred. So I appreciate the notion. We would like to work closely with law enforcement. We would like them to utilize county attorney diversion programs. I think that would add for some uniformity and consistency throughout the system within a jurisdiction. But this is not our language, and I understand the goals and the motives behind it. I think it's positive generally.
Madam Chair?
Maybe it's sorry, Representative Drazkowski.
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Mulry, I mean, is this if we would lay this over, could you and Ms. Ryder work that? I mean, it sounds like there's a lot of agreement on the direction of it, but it's kind of messy to work on here, word by word as we go back and forth. Is this something we could bring forward later, and maybe work on the rest of the bill? What's your thoughts, Representative Mulry?
Representative Mulry.
Madam Chair, I guess I don't understand. Do you have another meeting, or?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We've got a lot of meetings.
Representative Mulry, we were talking about maybe bringing the county attorneys into the decision-making around the diversion, maybe with input from the peace officer instead of the peace officer actually making the decision.
Representative Mulry.
Representative Mulry, I believe that someone from the public defender's office would like to.
That's what
assist.
I was just going to say. I think Mr. Stewart wants to.
Mr. Stewart,
weigh
if you could clear
this.
It up, we actually have two committees that are supposed to start meeting at 5 o'clock.
Thank you,
and
Madam
so we either
Chair.
Need to cut through and make this really, really clear so the committee can do this, or we need to just.
Thank you, Madam
night.
Chair. I think I can do this. I'm John Stewart. I'm the state public defender. There already is county attorney diversion in statute in Chapter 244. However, a lot of law enforcement agencies have started their own diversion programs that divert the child before the case gets to the county attorney. The Department of Public Safety studied these in the summer of 2012 and issued a long report that said that this was a good thing because it was more immediate. The kid would get involved in a program and do something to be held accountable right away. So it's recommended that the police agencies and sheriff's offices have the authority to have a diversion program in addition to the county attorney's diversion program. They don't have to do it, but they can. And right now in Hennepin County, for instance, there are 11 law enforcement diversion programs operating. The City of Minneapolis Police Department has a diversion program, and the county attorney doesn't want to be responsible for the police department diversion program. They have basically a two-level approach to diversion. The purpose of this bill is to authorize that. It doesn't take anything away from the county attorney's office, but it creates another possibility to have a resource to get this kid on the right path.
All right. Thank you for that clarification. Representative Drazkowski, I think we have chatted about these amendments. You ready to vote, Representative Drazkowski?
I think I'm ready to vote if you are, Madam Chair, if other members are. I just one last comment. I know I'm looking at Representative Paymar, and the police officers in some of our jurisdictions in the state bringing forward diversion programs that are controversial, maybe might be the right word right now. I think if we do something like this, it has to be done right, and I don't know that we can do it in committee today right, especially in the next 2 minutes or whatever it is. So thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm ready to vote whenever everyone else is.
All right. Are there questions from members before we start to vote? We've got a number of these amendments. We're just going to vote on them and see what we have when we're done. Okay. Representative Mulry started with the A 807 amendment, and we already adopted the amendment that took the provisions, the sections out, and that was the A3 amendment.
So next, you wanted us to offer the A6 amendment, which was the county attorney's amendment. Is that correct, Representative Mullery, the A6 amendment?
Madam Chair, whatever order the county, okay. All right. A6, I'm not sure who, but I know the county attorneys want it.
All right, the A6 amendment is the one that adds petty misdemeanor, juvenile petty misdemeanor, or juvenile traffic. All those in favor of the A6 amendment signify by saying aye. Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. Next is the A5 amendment, which is the diversion amendment that we have been amending orally, that all of the oral amendments have already been adopted. So the A5 amendment is the juvenile nonviolent diversion, as has been amended throughout the process. All those in favor of the A5 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Division.
A division has been called for on the A5 amendment. All those in favor signify by raising your hand. Six. Six in favor. Those opposed, raise your hand. Motion fails on a tie. The next amendment that we had was the oral amendment, Representative Mullery, that you had, that you wanted to change on line 6.6. Is that correct? You wanted to go from three to two.
Right.
Okay. Members, on line 6.6, Representative Mullery wants to change the continuance from 3 years to 2 years.
No. From three additional to two additional.
Representative Druskowski.
Madam Chair, I would move to amend line 6.6 to strike the word three and insert the word one.
So I think you'd be, do we need to, because he has a motion to do two, you're amending the motion, right? Amending from two, oral amendment to go from two to three? Or
I don't think Representative Mullery made a motion, did he?
The chair made the motion.
So Representative Mullery wants to go from three to two. It's my understanding that there's some concern with going to two, and the folks would like to go to one. Representative Mullery, do you want to comment on that before we vote on that? Representative Mullery.
We've agreed after a lot of the parties have agreed to two additional, and I've spent a lot of time working on this, and I've come down from three, which a lot of people want, to two, and that would cover most treatment programs. And if we don't do that, then I just don't understand, Representative Chakowski. It doesn't make sense. If we're trying to protect the public, we want to get the youth into treatment programs and have them finish the programs. Without this bill and amendment, and if you do what you do, then they can't be ordered to go for the full treatment. So we would be turning kids out without the full treatment program. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've talked to the head of our, I don't know what his title is, parole or probation officers in Anoka County about this whole idea, and the most he was willing to go was two 180-day stays of adjudication. So that's doubling what the professional from Anoka County said. So when you say you've worked with all the parties, the county attorneys, who all of you worked with, have you worked with, I think the probation officers, the parole officers have some organization. Did you consult with them?
They've got different organizations. Madam Chair, they've got various organizations. I believe four organizations for police officers.
I think there's someone in the audience that wanted to talk about 2 years to 1 year. No?
Madam Chair, in addition to that, if you go 2 years, a lot of them could age out. And I'm not comfortable with that.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lisa Fernette. I represent the Minnesota Association of County Probation Officers. We have a bill that we introduced that had one successive 180-day after the first.
Okay. So do you want to vote on two first or vote on one first and then vote on two? We'll give Representative Mullery the opportunity to have a vote on two, and we'll have a vote on one. Okay, Representative Mullery, we're going to give you a shot to get two, and then we're going to vote on one as well. Okay? All right, so Representative Mullery would like to go to 2 years, and as soon as we finish on this vote, we're going to vote on one. So all those in favor of going to 2 years, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
The chair's in doubt. All those in favor of going to 2 years, raise your hand. Six. Those opposed to going to 2 years. Motion fails on a tie. All right. All those in favor of going to one additional successive period, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. All right. Representative Mullery, we now have all of your provisions in the bill, I believe, or is there another amendment to vote on?
No, Madam Chair. I'm withdrawing the bill.
Okay. Unbelievable. With that, the meeting is adjourned.